Granger, and I am chair of the Design Review Board, and I am calling the meeting to order at 2:01 for, gosh, December 4th. We have no projects today except for a voluntary review of a subdivision which will be going through the process in the future. But Heather had thought this might be a good opportunity. It's a very special piece of property. But this might be a good opportunity, seems as the developer is willing, to actually bring it to us, for us to consider it as sort of what would we put on our list of things that we would review in a project such as this.
So this is a pre-pre-a?
It's nothing.
It's nothing. Right.
But
it's like a pre-pre-a.
It's,
yeah.
It's an opportunity for us to start making a list.
Yeah, okay.
If we were to review subdivisions.
Right.
Gotcha. All right, got it.
Here's a live one.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Good.
And what would we want to influence in a project such as this?
Great. And does Matt understand at all any visibility to why we care about residential subdivisions?
I have my own opinions as to why
he has to be an island resident, and assuming he does not live in one of the worst subdivisions that we've had in the past couple of years, he probably is aware that our subdivision process at the moment has a more bias towards engineering standards than creative design, particularly site planning standards.
I mean, if we're talking anything like what's on Grow and Wyatt, then I think we're probably on the same page. Mm-hmm.
But we have very little visibility to what happens in some parts of the residential subdivision.
They're not in our purview
at this time, but we're pushing really hard to make them start.
And I would say the other thing that's interesting is that over the last year I've been on this board, I've gotten more people come to me, why didn't you guys deal with that subdivision? Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to, I don't think they don't realize that we were not able to. So with Ron Peltier's support, we're trying to.
Yeah. And I can't speak for what happened before I joined the Design Review Board, but it's almost 2 years, I think. We have never stopped ever requesting that we do look at residential subdivisions, and I'm sure that process happened before. Mm. And it seems reprehensible that we haven't been able to have visibility to those plans. Mm. Because the amount of damage done by a residential subdivision in clear-cutting it is infinitely greater than the kinds of small reviews that we do of individual buildings on Ericsson and so on.
I would totally agree.
Or some of the more recent things that have been coming before us are doing their fair share of damage
themselves.
So may I ask what the hold up or the process has been to get us to the point?
Well, the Design Review Board just does not have this in our
mandate.
Yes. Yeah. Mandate.
Yeah.
It's not in
your
mandate.
Sorry.
I love that.
As we have brought it up in the past. Which is why today is, I think, a sort of watershed point. We currently do not have any standards or guidelines for us to measure a subdivision against. And so in the past, past planning directors have said, well, the city council has to act on this, and there has to be some guidelines and standards in place in order to allow the design review board to take this under their wing. So it's sort of like we're trying not to get the cart before the horse, but we've got to start somewhere.
And at a recent meeting convened for the first time in history, that the design review board's 7 volunteer member group, the planning commission 7 volunteer member group, the city council, close to being volunteer group, met in one round, first time ever. And at that meeting, all 21 councillors, thank you to Ron Peltier, or people in the room, representatives of whatever group we're in, all 21 got to speak once and then got to speak a second time. And all 21 said, this is a major priority. The result in a meeting that we had with the city subsequently, the result was that our concerns were essentially not addressed at all, and that they belong on a Gantt chart timeline of indeterminate length and no specific position, certainly years or more out. So this gigantic priority that we see in something that needs to be managed, in 21 people, thank you to Ron, speaking to the city saying we really want to have this promoted as an agenda item, that was completely ignored. It seemed. Is that fresh, fair to characterize?
Well, before you ask Ron that question, let me just say that Gary Christensen was supposed to be here today to address where these items were on this time chart and how things were going to be scheduled. And we only found out this morning that he wasn't coming to do that today.
Because when you went there at the last time Gary presented, and we raised those same questions that we raised on that evening, and he's promised, he said, I don't know where it is on the chart, it's certainly not a priority. And today was his time to come back, and as we requested,
he told me that he was coming.
Big pardon?
I saw him recently, said he was coming Thursday night.
For some reason, he's not in the office.
Something came up.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so moving on for the agenda, does anyone have any ethics or any other issues?
Can I just chime in real quick? Because in terms of the, I just wanted to sort of add my two cents into this conversation. The tree cutting, I think it's more of a symptom of kind of a larger problem that we're grappling with as a society, right? Just living sustainably, creating buildings and having development support the health of the environment and human health and well-being. And I think, as Peter's mentioned before, code is sort of like, it's the worst you can do, right? And so if you're designing a code, well, that's legally, that's about the worst you can do. And I think the goal should be, how can we challenge like developers and development to be better? And so with the opportunities that we have with the recent comprehensive plan and identifying which items need to be prioritized, I think the design review board can hopefully play a role in helping push forward a more sustainable vision for development on the island. And I think it should include the subdivisions.
Great. So going back to the first agenda item, does anyone have any conflicts with regarding to anything that's going to be discussed today? Okay, I would like to disclose that about 35 plus years ago, I did do some work with Ray Stevenson, who is here. I have not worked with him in the past 35 years. But also, I wanted to disclose that I am close friends with one of the family members who sold the property to Ray that we're going to be talking about today. And over the past few years have had conversations with the family about the property, and that also was as recent as this weekend and today. So I'm fully disclosing that I have a connection to this. It has no bearing because the family has no longer any financial interest in the piece of property. They have sold it. Okay, so that's my disclosure. I think we can very quickly go through review and approval of the minutes, because we know everyone reads them as soon as they get them.
Wait for word.
Wait for word. So I did not find anything in the review of the September 11th minutes that needed to be revised. Do I hear
move to approve minutes?
A second?
A second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
And I did not see anything in the November 20th minutes that needed adjusting. Did anyone else?
Nothing good.
Do I hear a motion to approve?
I'll make a motion to approve.
And a second?
Second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
I believe that makes us caught up with our minutes.
No, we're still going.
No. I have them. Oh. But I had already published the agenda by the time I received them, so I will have them for the next week.
Let us go around the room and introduce ourselves.
Ron Peltier, City Council.
Charles Maybluth. Citizen Group ABC.
Matt Tierman, Council Member Elect.
Alan Granger, Chair of the Design Review Board.
Joe Dunston, Design Review Board.
Pete Perry, Design Review Board.
Chris Gucci, Design Review Board.
Jason Wilkinson, Design Review Board.
Ray Stevenson, Jefferson Fine Home Builders.
And Heather Wright, Planning Manager.
And
Carla Lundgren, Admin Support, DRB.
Thank you. I'm going to hand the floor over to you, Heather.
Hi. Well, thank you all so much. So I've got for you today the proposal of the plat for you all to look at. And as you'll recall, at our meeting a few weeks ago, there was an example that was brought forth from Mr. Quitzlin of a good plat design, and this is the one you all are looking at today. So we saw some examples during our discussion that kind of some of the plats that probably aren't the most favorably received. This particular plat is under review, just so you'll know where we are in the review phase. It's gone through pre-application conference, and the plat is has been noticed, and it is assigned to a planner, and it's under the review process. This property is approximately 27 acres in size.
27.5.
Thank you. 27.5 acres in size. The zoning requirement, it's R0.4, so it's 2.5 acres per lot. You'll notice that they're proposing 9 lots, and the lion's share of the property is going to actually be contained as open space. We talked at our last meeting that we have what's called the flexible lot design, so that allows you to make smaller lots as a trade-off and incentive for providing more open space. So you can see that the lot sizes range from the smallest of 0.62 acres to 1.1 acre. You'll see that the property is bordered by Torvanger to the north, and a portion of the western side touches Madison Avenue. The proposed access, as you see, is from Madison Avenue. We do have Annie Hillier, who is the planner that's assigned to the project. I don't know if y'all have had the chance to work with Annie yet at the design review board. So she will be taking this plat board, and she may potentially, depending on if design guidelines are crafted from this committee. She may be working with you guys more so in the future, depending on how that all works out. So, Ray, what would you like to add? I kind of went over some basics.
So we were asked to look at the property in early 2016 by a board member of the Bay Ridge Land Trust. The Land Trust had been interested in acquiring the property when the Quitzlands had decided to sell it. They had initiated this development concept, although at that point in time they were proposing 11 lots rather than the 9 lots. They essentially had 2 more lots extending around towards Madison. And so we looked at it. We've done projects on Bainbridge for a long time and thought that the project was particularly interesting because of the amount of open space, the ability to work with the Land Trust, which upon final short plat approval, the open space will be conveyed to the Land Trust for perpetual open space with the trail system shown that it currently exists reconfigured to go throughout the open space area. Land Trust has some other thoughts in terms of stream remediation and different permit processes that they're also interested in pursuing with the property. So we looked at it, thought it had a lot of merit, elected to remove 2 lots from the concept because we felt that it would aesthetically be better to, as you come in off of Madison, to see a tree-lined open space area rather than single-family homes immediately adjacent to Madison there, and have been going through the process with the city. I guess the other thing that that was interesting is that because of the percentage of open space exceeding 65%, the Department of Ecology storm drainage rules regarding direct discharge and opportunities available in terms of how we deal with our storm drainage became available. And so that's the complexities really that we're trying to work through right now. I guess my understanding was that initially the city code would require that access be off a Torvanger. However, because of the grade difference at Torvanger, at that area, that was deemed to be not desirable, and so it worked through the process to come in off of Madison, although we need to extend utilities up to Torvanger so that water, the water main can be connected between the 2 streets.
Torvanger sloping up.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's a big bank right there.
Yeah.
So I have a question, and maybe Heather can answer this, or maybe you can. And I'm not going to ask it the right way because I get confused on this. But last fall, we talked about the SAD. What was it one time called SAD, the Surface Area Drainage? Is that what? What it's now changed name.
To SAR.
Mm-hmm. SAR. Yeah. Okay, right. And that's now been implemented. And has this project come through that process? Is that what you were talking about?
We actually have predated that process,
okay.
And we've been
okay.
Working with Peter, going through Department of Ecology manuals to so that this does satisfy the LID requirements under DOE. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't specifically gone through that permit because of when our application was. But it's a different concept, but it's essentially the same thing.
Is the concept that for stormwater that it slopes down towards these wetlands and is allowed to percolate naturally?
Well, to a degree, it becomes a little bit more complicated because of the lots closest to Madison and the ability for water to be able to migrate across there and down. So you have a variety of systems, which is really, my understanding what ecology wants to see now, rather than in the old days they would require we build these big storm basins and things like that. It's now each thing has separate parts and pieces that are handled separately. So there's separate approach with roof drains, a separate approach with driveways, a separate approach with the roadway. Just as you come in on the right through the open space, there's a large flat area, and the roadway drainage will tend to be moved over there and then split apart, and so it can migrate down. But ultimately, yes, all the water naturally works its way down into that drainage.
I wonder, because we don't have contours on any of these drawings, I wonder if you could the stream, the Type F stream, is it flowing east to west? I'm assuming the storm drainage is flowing to the southwest. Is that correct?
Yeah, if you're looking, let's see which map you guys have.
Southeast.
So essentially, the water's moving to the east.
That's why
it's moving down the east.
Coming down this way.
So the stream.
So from the southwest, you can see there's down through there. So, and from an elevation standpoint, you're probably. I'm looking at a contour map right now. The lots are perhaps 40 feet above the lower area. If you think about Torvanger and where the church is, and as you go down the hill, it basically follows that same topography as you get down to the bottom there. And then there's a farmhouse right across the street on the right-hand side. I think it's blue, and an older barn, and you see that right here is the right off the property, right through there. And then that's all pasture in there. I think they have horses and livestock.
So just, again, I'm just trying to get an understanding of the topography. Is the stream running from your property onto the neighbor's property and then back onto your property? Is that what this...
Yes, it run. Yes, you can see right in the corner there. And actually, that stream is dammed up at that point. That's one of the things that the land trust is working with the neighbor on in terms of for remediation.
Yeah. Okay.
Correct.
And then that buffer, the 150-foot buffer from the stream, does that carry any of those additional 15 and another 15 feet?
There is a 15-foot building setback on top of that.
On top of that.
Yeah, we're not close at all to the stream buffers. The closest wetland is the one to the north. Actually, a large wetland, but it's a it's been degraded quite a bit over the years. I think that they planted some trees in there and it harvested it, and it's actually there's a culvert across Torvanger which drains into that there. But all of these, we have one time I knew, very thick wetland report.
What is the
with multiple iterations.
What is the significance of the 40-foot, 50-foot, and 80-foot setback around that wetland base?
Well, you see, it's interesting, too. From the city standpoint, depending upon the classification, 1, 2, 3, or 4, all of these wetlands are classified based upon the habitat, water quality, and other characteristics as either a Category 3 or a Category 4 wetland. With Category 4 wetlands, you then look at what's the intensity of use nearby. And what's interesting is that with single family, if you have a lot that is 1 acre or larger, it is deemed to be a moderate intensity of use. If it is less than 1 acre, it is a... if it's less than 1 acre, less than 1 acre, it's high intensity use. And the significance is that with high intensity use, you have a greater buffer. Consequently, where we were running into distance issues, we had to make sure that two of our lots were at least 1 acre in size so that those buffers would be slightly smaller than the lot next to it, which would be deemed high intensity of use. So it's not a collective approach, but it's a singular approach with each of the lots.
I don't know that my next question is relevant, but it just in terms of the involvement of the land trust, will the land trust be purchasing the land, or will they be getting an easement for the land? And I guess I'm asking you and Heather here, because I'm assuming if they're going to purchase the land, then we have to go through the subdivision has to go through an approval process before it's disposed of, in order for...
They could do it through a conservation easement, probably outside of the subdivision.
Our agreement, though, is that we are going to convey the land to them outright for no consideration. So we're giving it to the land trust.
All right.
Yes. Which, under my understanding, under the open space rules, open space may be held by a third party, such as the land trust. And so that's what the approach that we're following. We believe there's a lot of benefits with the land trust's involvement because of their stewardship of the property and the ongoing maintenance of the property over the years. And so we find it to be a pretty advantageous situation from our standpoint.
So if that is the case, I guess I'm curious, why are these 7 lots smaller as opposed to larger? Track A, Track I, Track B, it seems like the 7 lots could all be a little larger, still maintaining your separation from Madison. And I'm just wondering
why they were choked down a little bit.
Why they were, squeezed down a little bit.
Some of it had to do with the lots E through I on the east side. You begin to get into more slope, and so from a level area standpoint, when we inherited this and we continued with this approach, the road system was a little bit more to the west here, which caused the lots to be maybe not quite as deep. The one thing I do regret is that I think Tract A is not a particularly good lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that results from, if you'll notice right at the corner of Tract A, you can see actually where the property is. And the original proposal had the road going from there and coming up with a little bit sharper curve. However, the engineering department indicated to us that they would reject a variance on that curve. We felt that there should be maybe a little bit sharper curve because it's a neighborhood road. It's actually a 12-foot road for impervious surface reduction.
So you know, on the radius, there's 160,
yeah.
And they didn't want you to go to less than that.
The radius is
150. Well, maybe I'm not looking at the right place. I'm sorry. On this curve right here, it says a radius of 160, and you're saying... you'd like to have gone sharper, like maybe down to 100 or something.
Yeah, 120.
I was just talking about if you took the bottom out of the drawing,
right,
and not changing the curve at all,
right,
here, but just slid it down a little further. It seemed like I was particularly looking at, you know, this lot. Which
I think we had a better design for it that the engineering department indicated that they didn't want, because they wanted to see the access road truly perpendicular to Madison, and that we did not have justification for relief from that design standard.
That's what I'm trying to understand is that on the drawing here, I see a radius R of 160 degrees, 160 feet of front radius.
To the center line.
To the center line, yeah. And what you're saying is that they didn't want you to go down to 100 or something. But you could have kept if they had allowed you to go to 100, You could have dropped.
No, because the perpendicular. If it has to remain perpendicular, that radius.
Right, but you bring it down perpendicular, down farther, and you get 25, 30, 40 feet, and then you get a sharper curve.
That's the problem.
Yeah, but I'm trying to understand why the public works doesn't want that sharper curve, because it's a residential street and there's nothing wrong with.
We think it actually will slow people down coming in too.
Yeah, and
it's right. It can serve as traffic calming too. So
yeah. Sure.
Well, can I just remind the design review board? This is precisely the kind of issue we would like to influence. Mm-hmm. If the road design is producing an inferior site plan, we would like to be able to speak up about what's the rationale for this, and can a 120-foot radius work? Or
it's still a 20-mile-an-hour road.
Yeah, if it's this road serving this small number of lots. But Ray, our thought is, and what we're trying to do with projects that are not subdivisions, is look for ways that with a little flexibility on a specific standard, something can be improved, and we are prepared to put our weight behind making that argument.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why these street standards, I think, would be immediately something to go on the list of can we see some flexibility on these that do not preclude the safety of a road system or emergency vehicle access. And we have many sites where we have emergency vehicles turning into properties with a lesser radius than this.
I mean, one thing that we've talked about in the past as well is being creative with the street designs. So, like looking at moon earths, for example, which are done quite a bit in Europe, where you don't have to have a curve. It's more of a meandering street. It creates a sense of community, and then it can deal with stormwater, rain gardens, and such. So, you know, that type of flexibility and those types of conversations get missed, you know, if it's just engineering.
Yeah.
Chiming in on that.
Yeah. I have kind of a big picture question, and that is sort of just curiosity. I think one thing we're looking at, I think, is we're trying to find out what are the incentives to, you know, better design and whatnot. And so the SAR was designed to say, as I understand it, that instead of placing a building on a piece of property and then looking for all the other things, that the other things are more important and the building location becomes less important, okay? Which then forces a builder and developer to think a little differently. In your case, you got over here, because it was fairly obvious that the rest of this was in wetlands, right? So what I'm looking for is, like, on future subdivisions, what are the kinds of incentives other than just the wetlands that you would look at to do this instead of covering the whole lot? If this wasn't all in wetlands, you might have been out here more, right? So what are the kinds of incentives that would help go to this without the wetlands? Does that make sense? I'm just curious.
Well, you know, ultimately, you know, we try to, you know, we want to create the best result possible. I mean, I've done a lot of projects on Bainbridge for a long time. We did Hidden Cove Estates, which was a big project, complicated. It's the complexity, it's the cost, trying to understand where home sites lay out best. And now, you know, with you know, the competing priorities of storm drainage, and it's a much more complicated endeavor today than it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Certainly is. You know, so it's difficult to give you a list of things other than to just say that the, you know, complexity and really the my worry is the pre-development cost, the report upon report upon report, and you know we work with some people with modest budgets, and it's such a daunting process that you know it's difficult.
I think it makes contract negotiations pretty tricky because the time sensitivity when you're trying to deal with a very diverse group of reports and conditions, it's hard to be able to make a contract with somebody and say, yeah, I need this much time to do my due diligence, not this much. It certainly must push that way.
Well, and the process is really elongated. For example, my initial comments from the city came back November a year ago. Mm. Peter Corliss asked for some storm drainage comments. It took my engineer until, after they met, until July, 6 months later, to get them in. And now I'm still waiting for comments from Peter from July of this year. So we have been in this project almost 2 years. And if, you know, fortunately, you know, if we had contracted to purchase it, you know, we would have incredible pressure. Fortunately, we just purchased it. But, you know, we'd still like to get to the point where, you know, we can do something with it.
And can sorry I to get into the developer sort of book here, but with a site such as this where all of these lots are different sizes, do you anticipate the lots will basically be of equal value, or will they be value based on the square footage of the lot?
Well, the promise I made to the Quitlands was that we would not develop this and sell the lots. So we are working to, we intend to build.
No, I understand that, but you still have to assign the land value
right
to your final sale
price. There's some adjustments. I wouldn't say that the difference on these lots will be substantial. It's not like, hey, here's four super lots and then here's others that are not.
Well, the reason why I'm asking that question, I mean, I know I suggested moving the road down. The other alternative is to, which I think you mentioned that the previous owner had another lot on this on this area.
Yeah, actually, they had two lots there.
Yeah. If track A was actually over here, then it seems like all of the lots on the west side could become more equal in size to the lots that are up here, and potentially these lots through here could all be balanced out. That's why I was asking you.
Okay.
You know, it seems to me like if I were buying a house here, which is always the test, it seems like buying a house on this lot would not be as attractive as buying a house here.
Right. The way we always look at it is the last home we're going to build is probably on track A.
But I
agree with what you're saying. It's challenging, and that's the reason we've actually initiated now with an architecture firm. You know, we're fairly far along and with some preliminary designs for the homes, and you know, there's going to be multiple designs. There's not going to be a sameness to it. But what we wanted to do, to digress a second, you know, the other thing that we think is really striking about this particular area is that it's with the church and the older farms, that it's much more kind of an agrarian focus. So we're working towards kind of a transitional farmhouses and with
more the rural.
Yeah, with everything we're doing, you know, they may not necessarily have the front porches, but they're gonna be farmhouses with more glass and things like that that we're working through, and that's really so far so good, and we think that this will be a nice community from that standpoint, and not too large either. I mean, the other thing is that with those smaller lots, you know, years ago we would always do 3,000 square foot homes, but now we're talking 2,000 square foot, 2,500, you know, something in that range. So it's something that fits more within kind of the lot size.
Mm-hmm. I was trying to start building an argument for the engineering standards and make some flexibility. Because they were maybe pushing you into doing something which was reducing the value.
Well, yeah, I think it reduces the quality. We can do a nicer job with the entry if we had more flexibility.
Yes.
Yeah. We absolutely could. So when you're coming in, the person living in that nice that lot that you thought was really nice, that they're not going to just be seeing headlights all the time.
Yes.
You know, so they can come in. The fact that if you're dealing with a 12-foot road, you know, maybe there should be a little bit sharper turn to it, because it's really not intended to be some big thoroughfare where people just, you know, crank through it.
So what was your logic for not wanting a tighter curve?
They wanted it perpendicular to the road, and indicated that I had no basis for granting relief because there was no topography issues.
Relief from what you're saying is that they're saying 160 foot radius is the minimum radius.
It says we do grant deviations from the standards where it is determined to be necessary. However, I spoke to your engineer and told him that to qualify for one of the situations is not likely. You must have just cause for a deviation, and for what I've seen and the topography of the site, I can't reason it.
Okay, yeah, so let me ask this question then. All right, so you don't have a profile here yet of the street width, you know, aligning through the street, but did the Public Works give you the standards for the street?
They have a lot more paperwork.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But I mean, did Public Works have a street profile requirement for you?
Yes. That we.
It's a minimum of people.
Right. And the particular engineer, he said, "Hey, this doesn't qualify, but we do this often in the county." And then we went back and didn't do it. Maybe it just needs more discussion. But as it stands right now, it was, "Hey, this is an engineering issue only. There's no consideration to the design aspect of what you're doing."
Yeah, I guess I'm certainly not picking on you. I'm just talking about the Public Works. But
yeah,
I can't tell you how many hundreds of subdivisions that I've done professionally, and I've never heard of a minimum of 160. But, and I don't understand the rationale for why they're doing that, especially given, because number one, a tighter curve will slow the car down.
Right.
And start doing, it's not a runner thing that Jason's talking about.
Following that,
but it's following that logic. And then secondly, you have the less of a curve, the less the lights will be in a house. If you have a broader curve, the more the lights will be in the house, and you're trying to reduce that. You get a better lot that he's talking about. There's a lot of great reasons to do that. And Public Works is saying, no, we have to have some somewhat arbitrary 160 foot minimum. And I'm trying to understand what their logic is.
Well, there's a historic cut off of Madison right in that area. There used to be an old home there years ago. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's basically how this was set up. So now we have to revegetate that cut and move everything over 30 feet. And you know, gash through there again.
Yeah.
So, can I ask you another loaded question on this part of this? Why not have another lot down here? Why did you give up two lots as opposed to just giving up one lot? because it appears as if just by changing the self property line on tract I, and at least having a let's see, what have you got at the moment? You've got a 50-foot setback to that, over a, like a 125-foot setback here. You could get a another lot.
You mentioned it was
comfortably
view.
Down there.
Although we like the notion that when you pull in to this small street, that all you see on the right is forest. We like the window of that, as opposed to house. A little bit, and also, I told the land trust that when they introduced me to the property, I asked them, I said, what would you like? And they said, well, we really want the open space, but, you know, it would be great if you can take a couple of lots out of the equation, too. So that's just what we did. Now, I do think they're receptive to reconfiguring the lots in some fashion, and that hasn't all... Because of the storm drainage, my concern is that we end up with some retention pond requirement or something that we really don't want to see. We want to see as much tree structure as we can when we come in off of Madison, and when you go on Madison, it's a little enclave that's tucked back off the street.
But you could landscape around that.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have
the value of that extra lot and a little more cash or whatever to the land trust to help them out, and you do good landscaping.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody's a winner.
Well, can I ask, because of the land trust involvement, does the land trust anticipate public access to this property?
Yes.
And so is there an issue with regards to parking for the public who are... going for a walk here?
I think that can be a concern. That's a concern that we expressed to them. Some of this is solved by the fact that engineering asked us to reduce the road profile from an 18-foot standard roadway width with shoulders to 12 feet. And so, it is our hope that We still need to work through that a little bit with them, but this is not intended to be an area where folks come and park along the side of the road. It's just not going to be wide enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just wondering whether...
Typically what people do is they go to the church and they use that parking lot, yep. And they come and go through the trails. But
well, I'd like to... ponder this, not this specific project,
yeah.
But more in the context of what we're trying to suss out,
mm-hmm.
of what we would look at if we were looking at a subdivision project. So just imagine for a moment that the property that is coming
right.
to is
right.
this,
mm-hmm.
is only this.
Yep.
What are we seeing that we would comment on other than a road radius? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's nothing that we haven't seen in 1,000,000,000 subdivisions everywhere in this drawing in that boundary. So what sort of purview or commentary would we have on this project other than, yes, they're great rectangular lots, oh, they're the different sizes, oh, the road could be bent a little bit more. I mean, to me, these are not very deep or relevant or provocative questions that would actually improve the project in a significant degree. And I'm just putting this out because I don't know what the questions that we should be asking are. Why do we have to have straight line lots? Why aren't
right.
we taking other things into account? What about water and sunlight and photovoltaic power and rainwater reuse mm-hmm. systems, blah,
yeah.
blah, blah. So
I think the thing to point's well taken, and that is that there's this macro of the whole site that we're looking at, but then within each individual lot, there's a series of guidelines that we ought to be talking about. Okay,
right. And because most of the subdivisions that come to us are not going to be so
not going to have that.
We cannot build on 65%
right.
of the land.
Yeah.
Right.
So like the one thing I would say right away is that, and it happens especially when lots are smaller, like down on Wyatt, the Horton, D.R. Horton, the ones on Wyatt. you know, they're all right on the setback. It's very ugly. You know, can we have variable setbacks? Can we put variable setbacks into the code requirements? You know, like, you know, so that we require forward, back, and so we get a variety of visual. So some people would plant more in the front, some might plant less, and then as you're driving, you're getting a more interesting roadway. I think that's one thing that I'd like to see the design review board look at in subdivisions, is how we do that. That'd be one thing. Then you're talking about some of the other things about, can we get solar and can we get more sustainability, rain gardens.
Yeah, different ways to look at this, and one of them is the aesthetics of space and form, and the other is the environmental functionality of space and form. I don't feel like our codes are written to do this in any way, and right. Maybe the comprehensive plan kind of makes some nods to that, the new one, that we should be stewarding and blah, 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 stuff like that.
I agree.
So, you know, if all we're going to do is comment on roads and lot sizes, I don't see us having much impact.
I agree.
The other requirement that we have here, which I, as a citizen, I'd rather just give the city the money, is that they have us down the entire length of Torbanger running a bike path. And I look at it and I say, well, if that's a partial bike path, do I want to have it going downhill where everybody's going, or should it be across the street the right way going the other way? And is that really where the next bike path should be built? I'd rather provide the money.
Yeah, and this is a bits and piece approach that all of our planning takes. Is yeah. One lot does not relate to the next lot.
Okay.
You build a sidewalk because ultimately down the 20 years there'll be a complete sidewalk.
We just had to do that down Old Mill Road where we did a short plat across from the cemetery, and it was 1,000 feet that our clients had to build of a pedestrian walkway, which I will guarantee you in 2 years will be overgrown with weeds again.
Can I offer something?
Oh, of course.
So when you guys review subdivisions, or not subdivisions, site plans, conditional use permits, I hear a discussion about the buildings as well. And we're not there's no discussion about buildings, just looking at the layout.
You haven't given me a chance yet.
but I don't
see any buildings here, but I have an opinion
at some point
about what these buildings could be in a worst case scenario. And not Ray, I'm not saying this is what you would build, but we've got some of these lots, narrow lots, take a setback on each side, build a triple wide garage. Now we've taken up about 50% of the remaining lot width and basically walled off the sort of lot, and the same thing on the next lot, and the same thing on the next lot, and it's creating the potential of you know what could be considered a very attractive drive in, see the trees, you go up the street and you've got 50% house, 50% garage, 50% house, 50% garage, all the way up and around the rest of this property. That run is not something which fits in with the character of this part of the island. But it's you can see this all over the place. You can see it up and down Madison, actually, further down, getting closer to the highway, where they just build the boxes with the big garages fronting. And at the moment, the subdivision doesn't talk about that. Single-family houses don't come back to
this
it.
This could have a common parking area.
No, I'm not suggesting that. Maybe the garages have to be side entrance. You know, they're not on the front of the house. They're on the side of the house. So that you're not being presented with I know it's only a small number of, it's eight lots that I'm talking about, but eight lots is 12 garages. Not necessarily, but it could be 12 garages with vehicles parked in the driveways as well, and a huge amount of paving between these garages and the street. And what we might be seeing as being a beautiful wooded environment with all these wetlands and streams, by someone that does it wrong, we could finish up with something there. We would have no control over, engineering would have no control over, any other department in the city would have no control over. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why we've got upset about some of the developments, like the subdivision on Wyatt, where it was just basically house, sort of garages.
So that seems to me, though, to be, try to combine Chris's point with yours and yours, it seems to me that most cities do this, is the subdivision review process is about the lots, and it's not about the buildings, and so we have this incredible review process for this, but then a person can come in and build any kind of house they want in almost any location they want, for whatever reason they want, and there's no review process beyond the subdivision lot lines. And so if we want to start instilling some, you know, aesthetic design guidelines or other kinds of elements that we feel help buildings to match, you know, the Bainbridge character, whatever that is, then we'd have to change the I don't want to say permitting process, but the review process to include that.
Well, let's go to the general residential subdivision standards, and we've got almost a page on roads and pedestrian access. Nothing about how wide is the curb cut going into the apron of a triple car garage.
How much of the lot
hinges are being paved.
Correct. We don't regulate impervious surfaces. That's great. Sorry.
Big degrees of difference of what we would aspire to influence. And there are programs and lots of bodies out of work there that could be referenced, like the urban planning, the city, Zagreb, Beck.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff, if that seemed relevant and important. Then there are building standards, like the Living Building Challenge, and so forth. And I mean, these are high, well, like I say, the degrees, there's high level paradigm shift and there's low level tweaking. And I think what we can discuss is what we want to aspire to in that spectrum.
You know, I always say in design, dream the dream first, then you back up your budget. Right? It's the best way to go, because instead of editing yourself, you get as creative as you can be, and then you figure out what's going to fly out.
Yeah. I think we have some advantage here with your participation, though, is hearing from the position of the person that's in the trenches trying to balance a whole bunch of pieces, financial and experiential, etc. You know, what are things that make your hair, your skin crawl, and what are things that you might embrace?
Well, I think the future is going to be more innovative design. Whether it's talking about projects that are public-private partnerships, where you're using Friends of the Farm and others like that, you know, community garden areas and things like that, things that may not lay out under conventional subdivision rules. So it's almost like you would be better if you have a binding site plan for residential process that would allow an applicant to have a streamlined approach to get to the finish line, but with the flexibility that it can come before the design review board. And these things that are really hard to to categorize, but which, you know, like what Alan's talking about, you know, maybe it's footprint limitations, or maybe it's impervious surface limitations, or it's where's your solar axis, it's all those things that it can be designed in collaboration with, you know, multiple perspectives. And you get that, and as long as, you know, it's not going to take you 5 years to get your approvals, then, you know, the development community will embrace that. Yeah. And that's really good, I think, really good design. That's the reason why we promised the Quitsons we weren't going to sell these lots, because we all see, I've been here 35 years, and, you know, there's some great things, and then there's some really kind of bad things.
I think also, Chris, going back to one of your earlier comments, you said, you know, if we were just looking at this property here as a subdivision, the reality for this piece of property is we are not. And the family ownership of this land has created the potential for the best of the best, because they have already respected a huge portion of this site being maintained in a natural state. There's a huge portion of the site could not be built on because of the wetlands and the streams and all of that.
That's why I was pointing out that not in this...
Not this site. Not some other site.
No, right, I know. But
the future project,
that's why I was going to say,
like this.
What would we when we start to focus say? On this piece here, I don't want us to forget
the other. Yeah.
But we've got a best of the best opportunity here.
Sure. But I think his point is really, because we've got a best of the best, now's a really good time to go, what if it was not the best of the best?
Sure.
What are the kinds of considerations while we're having an open discussion that we could brainstorm? And, you know, I'm just really glad when you said community gardens, that thought hadn't occurred to me. You know, what are all the best things that you do? Yeah.
I'd love to do a project with a big community farm.
Yeah.
I think from a business standpoint, it would be extremely marketable, and it would be very just completely consistent with the Bainbridge.
You know, Wacky Nut
has
that one. It's booked. Every piece of that community garden is fully booked all the time.
Yeah.
That's a really well, and it's in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's not handy.
Yeah.
My wife goes to that thing, and we're on 2.5 acres. But she still goes for the fun of that community.
Yeah.
It's really, operates really well.
Helen, is it possible to bring up an aerial, a Google map that shows the land, please?
While he's doing that, let me ask a question about pathways. I live over by St. Barnabas, off of uh-huh. St. Barnabas, uh-huh. and I walk my dog, and I walk a lot on Eakin,
uh-huh.
Eakin Street, uh-huh. and they have those little walkways between the homes, you know, that you can walk through. It's part of the waterfront trail, and you can walk between the homes. And just looking at this, I can see where, even though we're out at the north end or middle north end of the island, we still want to make it a walking community.
Mm-hmm.
There's no ability at this point with this drawing as to how you get to Torbanger on foot, for instance, you know. So you can either follow one of the easements, or you could cut a trail between lot F and G or something that goes over to the wetland A area, and then have a little trail that goes back and goes to Torbanger. I mean, I think that's a little thing. It's not a big site, but I think the city needs to be more diligent about asking for those kinds of things from people that don't seem to cost a lot of money, don't seem to be that big a deal, so they can have access and walk out on Torbanger.
That's why I was asking about what would the land trust do in terms of public access.
Public access.
Oh, yeah. Right. We have agreed to work with the land trust to, when we're doing our development, to figure out how to reconfigure all these trails to create a trail system that goes throughout all this open space, so that there would be, even though parking is a concern off of the road that we'll be building, so that there is an opportunity for Madison all the way up to Torvanger and through there, much like what we ended up doing in Hidden Cove when we built all those trails in there years ago. Maybe a little bit more rudimentary than that. I'm not sure where the land trust, how developed they want those yet.
I really appreciate that, but what I'm really, I think I'm really, in this case, not really talking about this project so much as talking to the planning people, you know, that you guys, this should be part of your everyday review and requirements to get that in as much as you can, because there are developers who don't want to do that, you know, and so I think it should be part of your review to have more of that and to be thinking about those linkages.
Sorry. I was so focused on loading this up. I want to make sure I hear what you just said. Can you repeat
that? What I was saying was within the tract of homes, okay, even though it's on the north end of the middle north end of the island, you still want a walking community.
Okay.
So if you're in tract F or tract D or C or G, how can you have a pedestrian walkway to Torvanger?
Okay, gotcha.
You don't want to follow the road to go down Madison to go over to Torvanger. And so we want to do paths and other things like this. And there are developers who would be proactive, as Grace talking about, in doing these things. But there are developers that are not.
Right.
It's not clear to me that through the planning process, the review process, that always gets addressed.
Sure, you're right. I mean, we tend to focus on the non-motorized improvements and making sure they provide anything on the frontage, but not always necessarily through the lot.
Right.
I know from our homeowners in Hidden Cove that the trails are the best amenity that we've done in any of our developments.
Yeah.
That people love the trails and they want to be able to walk. The neighbors on Torvanger say, are you kidding me? You've got to put a bike path down there? That's nuts.
Yeah.
But that's the way it is. Again, I'm not trying to get out of a requirement, but
sure.
I'd rather contribute the money for a better cause if there were a better cause.
Okay, that's good to hear. Yeah.
So, Jason, you usually have a lot of
things to say
about how to build more sustainably.
Sure.
What are your thoughts on that? Not this lot necessarily,
right,
but a lot. Yeah, a subdivision.
Well,
I
like what you said earlier about that things are moving towards more innovative solutions and collaborations, because I think that oftentimes what we get out of code and, you know, green building rating systems is less bad, right? And I think what we want to move towards is what does good look like. Right, and I think that is about more of a conversation, and there are examples like the Living Building Challenge that Chris mentioned, and the Living Community Challenge, which tries to get at that, and it sets not necessarily, you know, points and ratings or minimum code standards, but it really says, it opens up the questions. Here's the goals for stormwater. We want to be basically like pre-development standards. So we want to deal with stormwater on site. We want to capture all of our energy on site. We want to capture all of our, you know, potable water on site. And then it becomes a conversation, right? The design team, the developer, the designer review board can participate in that. And it's not just sort of like, well, let's make sure we get the curves right on the street from the engineers because they have certain standards. Maybe it's the fire truck widths or whatever. But it's more about how do we get it to the point where what we're building on the island isn't causing irreparable harm, right?
Yep.
And I think that, you know, that's, there's potential now with the comprehensive plan that was passed to integrate those ideas and to change the way that development happens on the island comprehensively, right? And the green building code could do that, or it could just put another series of check boxes, right? Like, we've got our guidelines, and, you know, people come in and they say, oh, I meant this because I screened this, you know, parking lot, but it's still just less bad. And so how do we come up with something that actually creates real creative solutions and works for the community and works for the island? Because the island is kind of a nice microcosm, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice analogy for how we need to live, right? We only have the sun that falls on the island when it's sunny out. And we only have the water that's available in the aquifer. And so we should treat it with respect.
Yeah. You know, one of the other things that you brought up was really interesting was that the trials are the most popular thing. And when I talk to realtors, their frustration with the kinds of houses that they're having to sell, like the development on Wyatt, again, that's not what we need. So we're not, folks aren't developing what we need. So in terms of what's saleable, what's the ideal features and benefits of a development has a lot to do with what does the market truly want too, not just what you can develop or what your skill set is.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether there's enough conversation between realtors and developers, so that developers are developing things that realtors know they can sell. Because if you said the best-selling thing is, or the most popular thing is trial, you know, that would seem to say to developers, think about trials all the time, because they help sell properties.
Yeah, and not only that, like the houses that are being built on these tracks, they could be off. You know, they wouldn't have to pay another utility bill if they were completely independent. Like, they could have solar power, they could process their, capture all their own rainwater, and that's being done. Jason Clement's house, my boss, he's going after the Living Building Challenge, and he did it independently on one on his house. And but obviously there's benefit to scale. So this scale, you could do a lot just by integrating those systems together. And people are asking for that. People are looking for that. People want homes where the materials are selected so that they know that there's no cancer-causing agents in those buildings. And that's you know, those are high aspirations, but at the same time, they make sense.
They do. You have to juxtapose it, though, with, you know, we're slowly moving in that direction, but it's been primarily budget-driven, too. I mean, you know, our biggest worry is that the cost of construction is so high that all of a sudden, you know, it costs $1 million to build a home. And we don't necessarily want to do that. I mean, we'd like to figure out how to do innovative design, but be able to not just create one spiral, you know, have it continue. But you don't do it, in my opinion, the way others on the island have recently done it, where they've just kind of mindlessly gone through their plan books and picked two plans.
Exactly. All interesting point, too, about potential shared things. I mean, one is, I'm not sure how these houses are heated or cooled, or how water is created, but when you have a bunch of properties together, you can share a ground source system.
Yeah.
I mean, we've done projects like married student housing that, you know, several buildings all
like participating ground source heat pump type, but yeah.
Right. Yeah, and then also you look for the potential savings. So these connections, these utility connections, those are costing the project.
Right.
So if there's a way to disconnect from those, that's money that you can pull from to put into other sources. Right. So if you capture your rainwater, for instance, and if the city will allow that, and actually they have. So you can, you know, that's a possibility. Connecting to the sewers. I guess it's a septic.
Septic, yeah.
So some of the things that you all are highlighting are making me reflect on our HGDP ordinance, and through the HGDP you can get some flexibility in standards, right? You can deviate from the setbacks, or you can create different buffers. In the trade-off is you're getting a variety of unit sizes, unit types, and you're implementing the green into the development. And I'm just wondering if there's a way to maybe hybrid our HGDP ordinance and apply it to subdivisions.
Do you think HGDP's work today in terms of what we've seen?
In some ways, yes. Mm-hmm. I still think there's ways to improve upon it. But I think in some ways it's been successful. But I think that we can do even more. But I'm hearing things like this kind of suite of green options, right, where you're looking like solar access and cisterns and various alternatives to heating and cooling, you know, are there ways that we can incentivize that in the subdivisions, the way that we do with an HDP project that might accomplish some of what I'm
part of the challenge though of HDDP is then that just encourages heavier density, which sort of negates all the stuff that you're trying to do.
I don't think density needs to be a part of it. I'm thinking more about the other.
I disagree.
What's that?
We said not necessarily.
Oh,
well. Yeah, I mean, I actually disagree. I think that you could have one poorly designed conventional home, and it would probably, you know, be outperformed by a very well-designed, dense community.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think it is a matter of maybe combining these incentivized programs with, you know, opportunities for collaboration and folks who want to try and do something that's out of the ordinary. But allowing for very specific requirements, because the ACDP, it seems like if you put bike parking over here, if you put like a small sort of shared open space there, then you qualify it, and so now you get to double your density. So it's not enough, right? There's not enough of requirements or community benefits, you know, as part of that process. In terms of what we've seen,
right.
I don't know if that.
Well, I think part of the problem, I agree with actually both of you, but the problem is that the HDPs that we've seen have been in town in small lots, and there's not a lot of flexibility just trying to fit buildings in there, right? I mean, if you're looking for community values, you're looking for community gardens, you're looking for rain gardens, you're looking for playgrounds, these kinds of things. What happens is the ones we've seen in town just hasn't been big enough, such a small place of 9 units, that there's no room to do that. If you did it up here, there's a lot of room to ask for a lot of community items. I think the ones that we have seen, I think, have been too dense.
But is that because the land cost is so high?
Yes, that's part of it.
Is it that the land cost is so high that you just have to max every... You know, we see developments that are just, you know, they're packed in there about as close as you can get anything. And is that... I don't want to use the word greed, but is that driving the maximum profit when you could actually build it, as you volunteered to do, fewer units?
I don't know. I mean, 20 years ago, Port Blakely came to me, and I did the South Shore of Blakely Harbor from Fort Ward Hill Road. We had density of 32 units. We did 15. We said it didn't make sense to do 32.
Right.
Did we maximize our potential return? I don't know. But we did what we wanted to, which we thought was consistent with the island aesthetic. Although some people argued, hey, look at those big houses that went in down there. Maybe it should have been more smaller houses. So I don't know.
What was the benefit, though, that made you want to do that? Was it made you feel good and that you were being a responsible citizen?
Well, some of that, but I also thought that it fit more with what we try to do on the island in terms of, you know, our approach to development, which is that you do leave things on the table. And we had a lot of issues down there because we had property that was fully treed that hadn't been touched for 100 years, and it was a before there was a moratorium on docks in Port Blakely. I met with the South Baybridge Community Association, voluntarily said, hey, we will not pursue a single dock.
Right. But how would we incentivize another developer who's less conscious than you to develop in that way? I guess that's one of the challenges.
I think all the things you're talking about are really great things, and that's where it's all going. And I think the way you have to incentivize them is through some sort of like I said, binding site plan process or what Heather mentioned, so that they know that, hey, we will work on this in concert with others, and we can get from A to Z with certainty as long as we all collectively work through this, and it's not going to take 3 years to do that.
Fast tracking a project has a lot of incentive.
Yes. I mean, this is a short plot, and we're already a year and a half.
Which is ridiculous. for considering what you're trying to do.
Well, I'd say, you know, what's made it a lot more complicated today is the whole advent of all these storm design rules and I couldn't imagine trying to do something with less open space. I mean, I can't imagine trying to come in and do just a regular subdivision today and meet the the criteria for storm.
So are these fundamental code issues? It's, you know, it's the writing of the code.
Yeah.
And so to fix these is a multi-year process of code rewriting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to say which codes need to be prioritized to be rewritten first to enable this. Mm-hmm. And is that the reality?
I think so, because we're only a recommendation body, right?
Right.
So when we say we want to do blah, 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 the developers come back and say, where does it say that? Someplace,
right.
You know what I mean? And so we have to look back and say it's the building code, right? And that needs to be updated now that we have a new comprehensive plan. And I think what they're looking for, what you guys are looking for, is what codes need to be tweaked and changed.
Right.
You know, that's what you're looking for.
Right.
And
right.
Yeah, and so what ideas can we give them that they can say these need to be changed to reflect whatever it is we need?
Correct.
Heather, I have not had a positive attitude towards HTTP in any of the projects that we've reviewed.
Okay.
Because we typically have been presented with an inferior design in the name of HTTP.
Okay.
As opposed to an improved design in the name of HTTP.
Yes.
And I think that that's... so important to I thought the city council was going to sunset it when it sort of lived its life, and then all of a sudden it was back.
I would ask how is it written? Because the best things come when everyone's sitting at the table: the developer, the planner, the tree person, design board, and we created.
It gets down to what was the original intention. And the original intention was to promote additional density and diversity of housing.
And housing costs. Yeah.
In order to address housing costs.
The green buildings also a big part of it.
Yeah.
Well, that became one of the...
that was in the original.
Yeah, it never seemed like it was focused around that. We didn't have anyone come to us and say, we want to do a green building, therefore we're going to use HTTP.
Yeah.
They came and they said, we want more density.
Yeah, we're doubling our density, and look, these are the little boxes we had to check to get it.
Exactly.
guess what? It wasn't much.
Yeah.
Right? HTTP
hasn't
been used rigorously.
That's right.
It was very nice that we got it.
Yeah, thanks.
So it's a tertiary benefit of it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
In the subdivision development, I mean, the projects you've been involved in, what are the main drivers? Is it just what the market wants? Trying to anticipate a market demand, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's, there's always been demand.
And a price point, of course, and all those things.
Yeah, you know, I think our customers have changed. I think we're getting much more moved down customers than we used to. When we did Hidden Cove Estates, it was all about families moving over from the east side and schools here, although I understand, you know, there's been an increase in enrollment, so it's hard to say. But, I mean, most of the people we work with, and unfortunately, a lot of it has to do with cost, too. You know, the fact that when we started, we would build a beautiful home and sell for $400,000. And, you know, it's just the inflation that's occurred in the land inflation as well as cost inflation. It's making things, you know, very expensive.
Aren't you looking at $1.5 to $2 million for houses on these lots?
Well, I hope not, but maybe.
You're looking for higher?
Less.
So what is your range of construction cost? Do you know?
300 a foot, probably.
300 a foot, and that's top end, more or less?
300 to 400 a foot.
300 to 400, and lowest?
250.
Lowest.
Yeah.
You can still do 250.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, we've probably seen 15% to 18% inflation in the last year.
Yeah.
It's just going up like that. And so everybody dumbs their product down to try to get their prices down, and you know, you don't want to do that. And that's the reason why, you know, from an economic standpoint, you look at this, and it hasn't been the city's delay. It's just a long, complicated process, and there's a lot of issues and a lot of workload and all that, so I get that. So, but I mean, there's probably $10,000 to $15,000 of increased cost per lot just associated with holding time from when this began. And it just keeps
so
piling up.
Mm-hmm. So, Heather, to your point then, if HDDP could work in a residential subdivision,
or something
like that, so that you've got a set of rules that say as long as you're inside this thing, you still have to somehow score it where it adds up to the value that you want.
Right.
At some point, you're still checking boxes.
Well, I think it has to be more discretion or more subjective in terms of the approval standpoint. I think it needs to come through a board like this that may be advisory, but where somebody has to. It's really difficult to quantify.
Yeah.
What's your worker? Look at it and you say, oh, that's good or that's not so good.
But somebody who wants to challenge that, some other developer at some other time, if it's not sort of quantifiable, you're always exposed to opinion, and that's going to be a disaster.
Right, it's difficult.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to quantify what it takes to create a good project.
Because that's what codes are. They're quantifications of...
Well, oftentimes codes are very prescriptive, right? It's very much like you do this and you get that. And I would be interested in an HDDP incentive program where it's more performance-based. And performance being like, if you achieve the Living Building Challenge, then you get to increase the density by double or whatever. Because we know that, you know, Living Building Challenge projects don't have a water bill, they don't have the electricity bill, they're not contributing to the sewer, so they're less maintenance for the city. Mm-hmm. Right? And the city has less, you know, it's less impact. So, you know, I think something along those lines where it's more performance-based, and then it's supported by conversations like these that help streamline it and move it forward and come up with really creative solutions instead of, you know, maybe being confused about all the various prescriptive requirements that maybe contradict one another at times.
Well, our code is so complicated that it to decipher really what one needs to do is very challenging. And I've been doing it for a long time. It is the need for clarity, the need for really good guidance to staff is just... essential.
And is that everybody's code? I mean, when you've done other projects, other places, whose code's the best?
No, I found, you know, we've worked Mercer Island, Seattle, other places, and some places have their strengths and some weaknesses. I am always a proponent of, hey, figure out who's doing a really great job out there and figure out how they do it. Just reverse engineer your process.
Sure.
Don't always create something from whole cloth.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And there are, but it's really challenging. It's all of these mandates that just keep being thrust upon staff, and you know, then we complain about permits and costs and timeliness, and you know, it's a really, really challenging thing that they face. So
you mentioned earlier at the very beginning, saying somewhere 2,500 and 3,000 square foot. That seemed like a small house. Did I hear that, or did I miss it?
2,500, probably.
2,500. What's the incentive to go to one story versus a two story? Or is
The challenge with one story is your footprint size and figuring out, you know, how to do it. You know, I mean, the architects I work with, they all want us to do detached garages, and I look at that and I go, okay, I like that, but now I'm looking at my footprint, right. And you know, it's a real puzzle here to get everything to work because of the amount of impervious surface, how you're dealing with your runoff, your septic, your just everything. I think master bedroom down is a huge positive thing today. But you won't see them in these more dense communities just because there's not enough footprint in order to do that. You know, I probably have four or five customers that have lots that are subject to RUE rules just because of the overlay of wetlands and things like that. These things have been languishing. You know, I've talked to architects about it. I said, hey, we need to find out some innovative design. The 1,200 square feet really doesn't work. You know, they'd like to do a little house, cottage with, you know, bedroom down. Really hard to do. Attacking that whole issue is something that...
What about residential elevators in those kinds of cases?
I'm sorry?
What about residential elevators in those kinds of cases where it doesn't matter where the bedroom is then?
Well, yeah, $40,000
for a residential elevator.
Yeah, okay.
And you're only allowed to serve one residential unit with one residential elevator.
Yeah, I don't know, probably.
Yeah, I think it is.
Just because you don't want people to wire upstairs?
Take up
room in the building?
Yeah, you just need a little bit more room on that main floor. Just a little bit for, you know, we get, you know, our customer, you know, they're in the early 70s. And they said, we just need to have a bedroom on the main floor.
Yeah, so living in place kind of house. Mm-hmm. You can.
Yeah, they're selling their bigger home.
From birth to death, you know.
Yeah. Although a lot of it, what we've got here, I think, is we have folks like ourselves that live in bigger homes, and now it's maybe time to start looking for something smaller.
Yeah. So that's what I'm getting at. When I look at this, and I think of the traditional house that one might put on here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not necessarily what you're doing, but
yeah.
The traditional house, I see an assumption that people are going to get older and they're going to move. And they're going to want to move into town. And they're going to want a one-story, and they can't get a one-story in town. I have a one-story house on a half acre, and I've been looking at condos downtown thinking, well, I might as well buy a condo because someday I can move downtown. They're all included a stairway or an elevator. I might as well stay where I am. I'm in a one story, I can live in place, die in place, you know, and I have a half an acre and I have a big footprint, but I have a half acre. And you've got more than that here, so you could almost build homes for one story, depending on how that works out with cost and things, you know. But I don't know if people would be ready to buy them yet. I don't know. I mean,
the designs that we're working on have mastered down.
On the upstairs.
But typically they may have two bedrooms and upstairs, so it'd be like a limited upstairs, but with a master down.
So I guess going back to you guys, it seems to me that there's some issues that we're interested in on the macro site, you know, and a lot of the wetlands and stuff maybe is taken care of with SAR and some other those things.
Yep.
But then when we get down to the individual lots, it's not just the lot and the street that we'd be interested in, but also I think within the lot, mm-hmm. you know, like setbacks, bearing those setbacks, having... all the things we've been talking about.
Well, and things that allow a community, several lots, to utilize a single resource.
Single resource, yeah.
I'm not saying it's feasible, but if ground source, for instance, can be economized by scale, so can photovoltaics and so can other systems.
Yeah, the problem you get with those is who pays for it when it's broken.
Yeah.
So you've got to have a community.
You have to have an HOA.
Yeah, you've got to have an HOA with the fund to deal with that stuff.
Right.
But you have shared wells throughout the island.
Yeah,
you can do it on a smaller basis. You may not be able to do all of it, but you can. But you're right. It is awkward. Those approaches are awkward under our code today to begin to think about. You know, we thought about, okay, maybe we come in here, like Alan said at one point in time, where you have a common driveway and then you have like a carriage house that's jointly. So rather than two separate detached garages, and then I started thinking, oh... Okay, yeah, maybe that can happen under the code, but I'm not. It's just difficult. It's not the mainstream, and not sure that we could get that done.
You've been up to co-housing, haven't you, You know, how they've got a big, they've got a big parking garage for everybody. And then they've got a big room where they have community events, and they have smaller housing units. Have you been up there, Matt?
No.
Yeah.
I live there.
You live there?
You live there? Oh,
okay.
So, well, it's 5 acres. An acre was put into land trust to preserve one little bit of forest. And the house, it's an intentional clustering and sharing of resources. The houses are 10 feet apart, side to side, and across the path they're 20, maybe?
It's got a real communal kind of feel to it.
Well, it's not intentional in terms of sharing a dogma about anything. It's just an intentionality in terms of working together as a body of 30 households that stewards the land and the processes for maintaining the buildings and the land. I like to put, there's a big field with grass and there's one lawnmower and I've never touched it.
So there's that, and there's also Herbie's Nut Home that's down by Point Way, and I think it's
Bill Isley's deal.
You've seen that, haven't you?
Yeah,
you
Bill Isley.
Bill Isley did that?
Yeah.
Okay, has anybody else seen Herbie's Nut Home?
It's the small sort of clusters of...
Yeah, yeah, they're little houses. You have a common parking area. You walk to your house. I'd like to see encourage some kind of wacky innovation like that. I think all this kind of mainstream, we've got to build these middle-class houses for people who think in little boxes or who are just kind of conventional. I'd like to see us cater more to people a little bit eccentric.
Yeah, well, I'm working on a project right now with a 450 square foot. Homes, little teeny guys. They'll be townhomes. there's a big market for that. I actually floated the idea and was fully subscribed before I even finished talking the sentence. So I'll take mine.
Where is this?
I can't say right now.
Okay.
So, you know, there's ways to do that. And they work out pretty cheap, too.
Or what developer space is trying to get something that sells, and often I think that lags behind where people are or could be if they have the option. So,
and definitely code doesn't catch up as fast sometimes, or all the time.
So Heather, what does that mean for code change? I mean, when we've seen the trying to change the tree ordinances and stuff, you know, it takes forever. What's your sort of expectation? Is it always a citizen activity to change codes?
So staff can be directed from council to change the code. Is that what you're asking?
Like, yeah, how does it go about? Is there a way, because when I think about changing a code and I think about the tree ordinance, I go, that's taking years.
Sure.
But is that a matter of priority where instead of waiting for a citizen group that meets for 2 hours once every 2 weeks to change a code, is it possible that people are employed or subcontracted to just take the code and get it changed and the council votes on it and we're all good and it's taken a month or two or three? Does that ever happen?
So I guess I could give you an example. The Historic Preservation Commission, they rewrote their entire code. It was two commissioners and myself, and I'm not a long-range planner, so I don't generally get involved in code rewrites, but they met with me weekly for about 3 months, and it took us, I think we started the process in November. It took us about 5 months to go through the process. So don't underestimate what you all can do, honestly. Yeah. And, you know, like I've told you before, plagiarism is encouraged in the planning world. So I just Googled just to see who else has design guidelines, and there are residential design guidelines out there. Mm-hmm. So I'm hopeful that if you all maybe could choose some examples of places that you like and start narrowing down what you want, we would need to go to our council and get it on our work plan, and maybe a staff member could be assigned. So that's partially why Annie's here, because she might potentially, if it gets on our work plan, be assigned to this. So I think it could be doable in a 4 to 6 month period, depending on how much outreach you do and how well received it is. And I mean, from what I'm hearing you all say, some of what you're requesting is just more flexibility. I think there's options to do that within our existing code, and the only reason I drew up HTTP is because it could be a template for us too. I mean, we could pick out what things work and don't, but could that be our new standard for subdivisions as opposed to just a guideline? Because you were talking about concern, you know, if it's just a guideline, it's just a recommendation, do we really need to change our code to make it reflect these things?
But does it have to be us? Because, you know, like life happens. And some of us are a bit older, and you know, sometimes stuff comes along and it slows us down. Is it not possible that the city pays for a group of people to change the code?
Talk about a consultant that you would just say, do this.
They
get a lot of guidance.
Yeah.
They will. And there needs to be a three-day process.
Consultants do it all the time. I mean, they're.
They know exactly what you want.
They know. That's not that difficult.
Because I think that's the thing that's frustrated us when we've been trying to request these changes in the. We've been asking for this for a couple of years, got nowhere. But then the thought of what do we have to do to actually change it might take years more too, and it's kind of. For us, it's supremely boring to be implementing things in our own design review guidelines that we wish would change, but we can't change them, and we've done them for 2 years, hating them.
Well, but you know what that is, don't you?
What's that?
You've had a city council that has not been receptive to changing much, and especially involving the design review board in the development review process. I couldn't even get on the agenda this last summer. The mayor blocked it. He wouldn't even let us talk about it.
Right.
So it's who's on the city council. That's why it's so important that you get good people like Matt on your city council. That's what it's all about. You've got to have that partner, those elected officials you can work with.
Okay.
Otherwise, you're not going to get anywhere.
To bring us back to today's agenda, can I just ask another question? Given this lengthy process you're in the middle of, what has been the most frustrating for you in what you've been doing? And what would you what could have sort of opened your mind to more flexibility? I know you inherited a lot of work before.
There was a lot of good work done beforehand. I think that it's just the processing delays. It's the fact that you submit changes in July and waiting on the response from engineering.
Is
that a staffing issue? I think so. I mean, I have like 8 projects that all funnel to one person. I have no idea how that individual, who is very competent and very willing to work, so it's not a reflection on personality at all, but I have no idea how they remotely handle the workload that they're experiencing.
So we lost a development engineer this summer. As Ray has indicated, we have one development engineer. We just hired a second development engineer, but they're responsible for all the traffic reports and the geotechnical reviews and the stormwater reviews, and we have a new stormwater process, and we're just so busy right now with development proposals. So he is correct, and we do have another member, but it's still going to take some time.
It seems like, I mean, and maybe I'm just feeling guilty here, but we're constantly being sort of told that we're sort of one of the cogs in the wheel that hold everything up. And we've never looked at ourselves as being that at all. We've looked at ourselves as trying to be very helpful to move things along. Maybe not embraced by past staff as much as we could have been. But if the city has a severe understaffing problem in an area where projects like this are totally being held up, I mean, this is way beyond the results of the Latimer report. I mean, Latimer report could have just said, I have more staff, and get on with it. Instead, it's taken 18 months, and I'm not sure that we've even seen the timeline for what's going to happen when.
The complexity of the issues that we present to staff today are so much more multifaceted than they were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. It is, to review things, I could see 10s and 20s of hours just, you know, associated with it, and it, there's just not enough time.
Well, but again, if the city gets creative, just the same as with building permit review, engineering review does not have to be all done in-house.
I agree with that. It should go third party.
Go to a third party reviewer and give them a performance schedule and say, we need this back in a month. And you get it in a month.
Yeah.
Because they want to do the next one. So going through the lengthy hiring more people and the length of time that takes, I mean, we all know how long it takes to interview and find well-qualified people, particularly in this kind of economic climate. The city can jump on this and hire outside review.
And I don't disagree for some reviews that that's possible. Part of that is the codes that we have. You have to have some sort of familiarity with those codes in order to review the projects properly. But we do have some third engineering review options for geotechnical reports. Part of that is it's an additional cost on the applicant, though, too. All of our third-party reviews, for example, for geotechnical, requires a $2,500 deposit. So with that is going to come additional fees, too. So, I mean, it's all
Time is money.
Exactly.
Time is money. If someone's sitting for a year, then having an outside review is probably not
worth that $2,500.
Right.
Sure. So,
who does that? Everybody? Municipalities?
Every municipality. They do it from building code to.
And then you actually get red lines and markups because they look at them.
Yeah.
And that's not being explored much here in the same way that these guys are going to have is everywhere.
We do have some ways to fast track for building permit review. So we do have some options within the system for that.
Did you get off on any of those options?
No, it's mostly, from my standpoint on this development engineering, I mean, in the planning side, we had most, what I think were pretty close to final comments, a long time ago. But, but what I also found is that as knowledgeable as the development engineer is, that when we got into it and really got into the code, he was getting confused also. You have 2,000 pages of regulations from Department of Ecology in terms of best BMPs for associated with complicated projects, and you get into things where they don't perfectly fit, and then there's some judgment, and then do you rely upon a stamp plan that comes from a licensed civil engineer who's gone through this, or do you feel that compelled to have to go through and redesign yourself? I mean, there's a lot of issues there, and that's where the holdup is. It's just really complicated stuff.
And would it be true to say that more development on Bay Ridge is going to be in more problematic places because some of the easy ones are already developed, and what remains is often harder?
Well, I agree with that. But I'm not a advocate of proposed changes or forthcoming changes that say that, hey, I've got to get a qualified arborist, and I've got to get a geotechnical engineer, and I've got to get this, and I've got to get that. By the time I'm all done with that, and again, I have a customer that, with modest means, is trying to build on a lot that was platted 6-7 years ago.
Right.
and they're going to be into $20,000, let alone the time, the sequential time. You know, I didn't get, for my civil engineer, it took me almost 4 months to get comments back because he was so busy. So we go there. Now we're another 5 months waiting for the review of the comments. That's where a year goes. And that is where the hidden cost in these things.
So it sounds like it's going to get harder, not easier, right?
We're hoping to make it easier, a little bit easier. I mean, just in the sense that. We hope that there'll be a little bit more predictability in the process, but things are constantly changing, and we're always, what Ray's describing is we are trying to interpret it, many lengthy and sometimes conflicting regulations. We're hoping to clean up some of that inconsistency and ambiguity in our code, but it takes time.
So Heather, there was
yes.
a great diagram showing where all the additional planning staff were being inserted to make planning work better. Is someone looking in the same way at engineering to come up with these are the holes that need staffing? If the staffing
yes.
is going to happen in-house,
yes.
is someone identifying all of these boxes that need a person assigned to them?
Yes, so there's a new manager over the development engineering staff, and that manager has identified, he's only been with the city about 5 months now, and he's recognized that there are is a need for more staffing in the development engineer team, and we do a biannual budget, so the proper time to come before council would be next year to ask for additional staff. We asked this year, which was a little ahead of the game, partially because we had a director that's been with us longer and has a study that's shown those gaps, because Part Lattimore did identify, not as heavily as you might suspect, but it did identify that we had some staffing needs. And the development engineers, the manager has caught on to that and is also just starting to really recognize that. So, yes, but it probably won't happen until next year that we're able to get more staffing in that department. And we're doing things to, I've partnered with the manager for development engineer, and we're working to create more templates and early review so that Ray can get comments earlier in the process. So we're working to put systems in place.
Ray, let me ask you this. You mentioned arborists, and I guess I'm interested in documenting the existing. You know that there should be a thorough understanding of the site, and I think arborists have a role to play along those lines for any project. And it's an issue that's come up before the design review board on past projects where we would like to understand, you know, if these are where the homes are being placed on the lot, where are the significant trees, where are the areas where conservation should occur. And I'm just wondering if there's, right now it seems like the code, there's an intent that's stated at the beginning of the code, and then there's just tons of conflicting and lots of prescriptive checkboxes that basically make even the city's engineers, you know, confused. So could we have a very clear intent and then more of a performance-based approach, and that would streamline the process for you? Would that be beneficial and still have folks like arborists be on call or, you know, be part of that process for you?
Yeah, it's a challenge. I understand the need for more details, typically always better, you know, in terms of the inventory. You know, you read the, which I actually have done, that six-volume Department of Ecology manual working on this to understand really what the criteria is. And I look at a lot of language that's in the DOE manual, and they say, hey, it's a good idea to have an idea of your tree inventory and your soils and this and that. But they don't say, hey, I need to have a qualified arborist provide that report, or I don't need to have a geotechnical engineer provide the report. I think that the information gathering process is important. I just worry about the cost associated with the professional designation of the people always required to provide it. That's my worry. We're just trying to figure out, you know, how to keep things reasonably affordable if possible.
Yeah.
Well, I think also, Jason, when you look at this diagram and look at the aerial photograph up on the screen, and you see the tree retention plan, and then the land where the development is going to occur.
Right in here, and then up through here, and then this is all will be retained.
Right.
And all the way across, all the way over to Madison.
And you can see the two dams here that hopefully the land trust would like to be able to get remediated.
This is fantastically positive, but it's happening because of the buffer requirements for streams and wetlands.
Yeah.
Well, although there is a scenario where one could go in there and create a extremely valuable property down in through here and through a variety of variances get that. So
no, we're not for these buffers and so forth. Yes, you could come in and terraform the old.
No, I was just raising the question of when there is such a large extent of tree retention, does that actually allow for a little less identification on the site that is on the portion of the site that is going to be developed?
It could be percentage based.
Yeah.
I think I guess the reason I bring it up is because it's just, it feels like, again, the code is so confusing, and so we have a stated intent, which is good, right? You know, stormwater. We want to make sure it doesn't run off into the sound. But the way that it's being implemented on projects sounds like it's slowing down the process, and it, you know, and maybe it's meeting that intent, but it's really cumbersome. And well, I just wonder if there's a.
I could probably have accelerated it by going the old-fashioned approach of putting the big storm pond right in where we come into the project. And I go, you know, hey, from an engineering standpoint, that's probably the perfect solution. You know,
would that been approvable?
Yeah, probably. But
so we're relying on your altruism.
Well, I've got a profit motive, and my buyers are reasonably discriminating, and I, my first couple projects, I had storm problems right where you come in the entry, and then I learned that that's not such a good idea.
Yeah.
Within your profession, you want to do the best you can. At least, you know, we all do. I'm sure.
Ray, thank you very much for coming down today. I don't know what
you have a good memory, Alan. That was 35 years ago that I met you and Sean back into your office in Seattle.
Well, I don't know whether anything that was said has been encouraging or helpful to you, but the conversation has certainly been helpful to us.
Yeah,
thank you for putting this together.
You're so welcome. Thank you all for emailing
me.
You're welcome.
It gives us a lot more food for thought as to how we proceed and try to help things move along appropriately.
Okay, great. I'm glad it was a helpful exercise.
Can I just say, I'm just I appreciate what Alan's saying, but I'm still worried that you don't have a good sense of the codes that need to be changed that we would like. And I don't know how we go there, but I don't want this meeting to go away and have it drop off.
I think you guys have got a pretty good grasp of what you'd like to see change, right?
Right.
You've all studied hard, worked hard.
Yeah.
You know what's good and what isn't. You must all have some sense of what you think or
what we're talking about.
We have some ideas,
of course.
But it's very good to hear from you guys, and I just try to take some notes about the things you focused on. But I would like to hear, after you all sat on this for a few weeks, the next time that you all convene, I'd love to hear more of your thoughts about kind of your wish list of what you would like to see changed.
That's what you're
saying. Yeah.
Okay. We could do that second week in January.
That would be great.
Okay.
That would be our next meeting.
Okay.
Great.
I do think that one of the hard things relative to the existing subdivision design standards is that nobody needs to actually identify what they intend to build as part of a subdivision application.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you get, I mean, they identify the lot.
Right.
Here's a lot. We're going to put a house in it.
Well, they have to do a home site area, so they do have to show about where the home will go. Yeah, but you're right. We don't have any idea what that house is going to look like, right?
No idea. So you get back to some of the things that I think the design review board would be interested in somehow inserting into this process is some general ideas of what is the design intent of the development which is going to occur on the land once it is subdivided.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the devil is in the details, and
right.
foes are the details that are going to get a positive or negative reaction from members of the public
mm-hmm.
when they actually see things coming out of the ground and they go, whoa!
Right. So
that is after they went, whoa, after the trees came down.
Right.
So I don't want to state the obvious, but I will. So you know, the only design guidelines we have for single family is in Fort Ward, right? But you all aren't reviewing Fort Ward design guidelines. And so it was interesting for me to hear Ray's wanting to design this kind of farmhouse to kind of reflect the agricultural use of the property. And how would you go about, because Fort Ward is a very defined area, it has the historic element, it's very clear what kind of guidelines should guide development there, but if you, like, what would you base those on, those guidelines? Outside of very distinct downtown areas that you know what you're looking, like, how would you know what to base this subdivision on? You know, would you look at the historical use as your kind of guiding element? How would you look at the surrounding character? Like, what kind of things would you all consider? Because it's so many pockets of the island are so unique, and we don't have anything to guide that.
I think the living building challenge might really help you with that, because, you know, ultimately, that's got a set of guidelines in it.
But it doesn't say what it's going to look like.
No, but I mean,
it does include beauty as one of the requirements, but it's very vague, right?
Yeah,
obviously,
absolutely.
Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But I think the idea that if the design review board is part of that process, then obviously there's a conversation that can happen, and we can help craft.
The question is excellent, because it's easy. Linwood Center has this thing,
right.
And all these things are coming from a characteristic, and
right.
the island characteristic could be interpreted in different ways, and also, you know, not wanting to stifle creativity and innovation. And so,
I think there's, to me, there's a lot of clues about what does a house look like. Does it look like people live there, or does it look like vehicles live there?
Yeah.
And I think
I think some basic.
You know, that is sort of a whole. You could write guidelines.
Okay.
Around that.
Okay.
Well, the presentation of is a garage closer to the street than the rest of the front of the house. That again accentuates an auto-oriented development as opposed to a residential.
Mm-hmm.
Character. So there's a lot of.
I think as we progress with these
pieces,
having a willing participant from the developing community could be very informative about what makes the skin crawl and what doesn't.
But I think to Ron's point too, the fact that this hasn't had a time on the agenda for the council. Is that right?
We did have a joint meeting with the DRB, Planning Commission, and the City Council, but that's pretty much it, yeah.
But not like a open...
Hasn't really gotten much discussion in City Council.
That feels like the other leg of the stool in terms of getting airing a lot of this in a much more public Tuesday evening forum where people can weigh in and electeds can have their feet held to the fire, so to speak.
The only issue with that, and I'll take this as a big issue, right now. You read the reaction of the general public on the island that followed a city survey as to which bridge they liked. You know what? We're gonna invite people to vote on the design of important infrastructure.
No, I
and you sort of read the comments as to what people said about the different bridges.
I think we're at the 50,000 foot level. I get what you're saying, but having you guys impart some of these ideas and learnings from folks like Ray, bringing up the living challenge, things like that, I think are valuable for folks to not to put up like A, B, and C house. Right. And A, everyone raise their hands. That would that'd be a flipping travesty.
Well, which is scary.
But,
I mean, that anything gets to that approach is very scary.
So Alan, I think the sort of getting back to what I said when I first started speaking at the meeting, the cutting of trees, these big houses, and these, you know, like built up to the lot lines, I think they're symptoms, right? And I think that the living building challenge or some, you know, set of principles in terms of deep green sustainability, truly sustainable instead of less harm, doing good, I think will create the climate in which we will have more beauty, right? And that's what's missing.
Jason, yeah, I hate to argue with you. I've seen lots of living building challenge buildings, which I don't think fit the beauty category.
But I think it's. I'm not saying it's going to guarantee it. I'm not saying that for sure. What I'm saying is that that beauty includes not only sort of an aesthetic form, but it also includes an environmental impact, a health impact, you know, and there's a lot of complicated issues around buildings, and I think the living building challenge or some guide of sustainability principles, if enacted, could help to create more beauty on the island. And that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying it's guaranteeing it.
So I think there's two kinds of beauty here. It's going to not to get too philosophical, but there's two kinds of beauty. And one beauty is the aesthetics of a building and that kind of thing. The other one is the beauty of a well-oiled working machine. And if you look at a landscape or a building in a landscape that is really working and really functioning well, I think that's a beautiful thing. And I think that's what you're saying, is you're talking about that. I think what he's saying is he's talking about more, you know, the actual visual quality of the building itself. And I think we would like to ascribe to both, you know, if we could do it. And I think that's what the whole thing about this meeting is, we're trying to get a subdivision that is a well-oiled working machine that's a beautiful thing, because it just fits and lets the landscape continue to evolve around it, as opposed to harming it in such a way that it's stuck and it dies, or, you know. So,
thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you.
Thank
so
you.
Much.
That's
thank
a
you.
Great place.
And Heather, if you would like to stay, I don't know if you know, but our next agenda item is Ron is going to talk about design review board and land review process.
Thank you.
Take a break. If you'd like to stay, I'm just inviting you to what he's going to be talking about.
Okay, perfect. I can stay for 15 minutes.
I have to get four different permits.
Really?
I'm just trying to do a job. 5,000 square feet of concrete.
Which you think would be the obvious thing to do.
But it's very good. I've been.
So with this
I'm doing tonight. So much paperwork. It's unbelievable.
Where is this? On the water?
No, I'm going to go to 4,000.
Oh my god.
Because it's a sand stream in the back.
Yes.
And I'm trying to demolish a garage that's here and take it away.
How's it called? Craig Christian's.
Everything about what we're trying to do is like.
Don't forget the punishment for doing good work.
I don't like the building challenge. I do. It does not hold up in the beauty category very well in my mind, unless we're prepared to spend the kind of money that Jason did on his house, which is a lot. So, you know, think about some of the projects that have been coming before us, and they're not really up that budget.
That's why I'm not saying you know it's necessarily the living building challenge, but I think what we're facing again, we keep dealing with symptoms, and I don't think we've actually addressed the disease.
Right. I'd like
to challenge you on your point about like cost, because I think, you know, like definitely for a single family residential project it can be more costly, but there's plenty of like cost studies and like even affordable housing projects that are achieving the living challenge.
Oh, of course, but they typically have a different commercial. It's on the way out to Crystal Springs.
I don't know the exact, it's very easy to disguise.
I'd like to see that you're going out.
The information of the first cost by looking at long term cost. Yes. I think you'd be hands down.
Well, of course, long term cost, there's no argument.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely, there's no argument.
But even in first cost, the first cost, the difference between the first cost is changing dramatically. So. Even the last week.
You can order these through the picture.
Okay, we're back.
So
all on the machine.
So it's been great. I'm really glad Ray came in and Heather with this. This is kind of, it'd be great if all the subdivisions were kind of fell into this category. I think it's important to remember when we're doing this, it's about the community. It's not necessarily about the developers and what they want. I think it's really great to hear from them, but they have a certain perspective. And it's kind of, anyhow, that's probably not that. But when I'm listening to this, it's obvious that there would need to be some work put in to establishing guidelines, design guidelines for subdivisions. And I have reason to believe that the next year's city council is going to be much more receptive to the council and design review board, and not just leaving revising the land use review process and all the regulations up to the planning department. That we want to be more developed, work with the planning department like you guys are. But I'm seeing that there needs to be a lot of work done. And the suggestion I have, I want to hear from you guys, because I think we can get some traction on this and move it forward. I'm thinking, you know, kind of in line with what you were just talking about, is abstract ideas like sustainability, aesthetics, what we're trying to achieve, and then how we convert that into what things actually, the form that things take. Because that's really what it's about. We have these idealistic ideas about function, and then what is the form that's going to create that function? So I heard a lot of things, you know, about this. How are people going to circulate through here? One of the thoughts I had was it would be nice to have some lot line easements for trails. So that if a neighbor on one side wants to walk over to the open space, you don't have to walk around everything. You've got a trail that goes through the other lots. You know, just little things like that. Just what is it going to feel like to live here? What is it we want to accomplish with site plans, subdivisions, and I really think we want it to reflect what we're about as a community, not just be another one of these cookie-cutter developments like we're seeing from these companies that come in from outside. They're doing what they do everywhere else. They know that Bainbridge is a lucrative market. They build something here, it's going to sell for twice as much as it would if it was built somewhere else in Kitsap County. And we just need to tell them what we expect and try and do it in a fair way that's efficient. We don't want to make that process a lot longer. But we do want to, from my point of view, I want something the community is going to say thank you for improving the quality of what we're seeing. So.
And does that have to be everything at once? Or can that be, what are the 10 top things that need to change and get that done? And then do all the other micro bits that come? Again, you know, watching the tree ordinance, you know, it's just so...
Do you know what we've done?
Oh, yeah. I know that you've been doing a lot of great
work. Have you read the critical areas ordinance?
I've been asking for a copy, actually.
Well, it's on. You can...
No, I know.
But it's in our agenda pack.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying knowing how long it took. Yeah. That's really my point. And for something like this, where Heather says you might be able to get it done in 4 or 5 months, to change the... to write those words that you're looking to find, to put those details on into code, is that what you're talking about?
There's a lot of stuff here that we're potentially talking about. We're talking about, okay, so what does a designer board, what would you think would be helpful for you to be able to review? And from what I've heard are subdivisions and capital projects. You already do schools. The city projects you don't automatically do. It's just when you're asked to do them. I think you should always be involved, like with the bridge project. I know that Mark did come here and talk to you about it, but you should have been in the progression of things that happened for that. So what is it you want to review? And then for each thing, you know, it's like for your site plans, you have design guidelines for the different districts in the Winslow overlay, and you know, like the four order, for whatever. So, if you want to, you know, we need to think about what is it you want to review.
I think we should look at the whole island in terms of overlays.
The vulnerability of some parts of.
Yes, that's.
I mean, such that all the island is covered by some overlay of some sort.
Yeah.
Maybe they're different. Maybe there's a Battle Point Park overlay. I don't know. And maybe there's this, but everything has some reference point to be.
I agree with that because we do the overlay once we get to a certain density, and then it's kind of almost too late. If we do an overlay of, say, Hidden Cove area, and we can affect change before all the trees are gone or all the streets become urban or whatever. So I think if we have an overlay zone up there, that's ahead of the time a little bit.
Yeah, and we did say we thought that at a meeting just pretty recently we'd love a Madison overlay because Madison is where we all end up. And yet Madison's under the maximum pressure.
We're looking at it and thinking it's maybe too late.
It's not too late. There's still plenty of nice...
So there's the scope of what we think the design review board should review.
Reasonably review.
And then there's the criteria, and there's the guidelines, the other criteria, like do we want to involve you guys in looking at tree retention? I know you're all concerned about it, it comes up. It's not part of the design guidelines as far as I'm aware. But I think it could be part of your, because you're going to be talking to developers early on, and it, staff does as well, and this comes up there. It's an aesthetic thing as well, and you guys are designers and artists and creative types. That
other bodies that are looking at trees.
Well, and
because I think the reason why I was sort of asking that question is. One of the things that we seem to be lacking at times is working together with other groups that have got a specific focus, whether it's historic preservation or whether it's tree preservation. We don't have to take everything.
No, we can't.
Onto our shoulders. But we perhaps need something in place that makes it easier to bring those people to our table, or to invite them to our table.
For example, sorry to interrupt, like the trees, we were saying that developers don't have to show us what trees are being removed, they only have to show us what trees stay.
It was a shock to us. That was
The Madison project specifically.
Yes, the trees that are staying in the buffer and that are identified.
Yeah,
but not only that, they have to be valued, and yet the trees we're taking out, they don't have to be valued, and yet that's backwards.
The tree units, right?
Right,
and that goes way back to that Grove project, where all the buildings were in places where there were trees, and they said, "Well, we don't have to tell you about those trees. We're taking them out."
Going away.
Is that true everywhere? Aren't there some places where your site plan you're supposed to have an inventory of the trees?
Used to be that way.
We do have an inventory of the trees, but we have the inventory of the ones that are being retained, because those are the ones that would be assessed a value if they were removed.
Yeah.
So if you can show, for example, if you have 40 tree units per acre, you can show in the ones that you're retaining that you're meeting the 40 tree units, you don't have to value all of the trees.
Does that make sense to you?
What I have found that comes up most is from when I've received public comment is that there are particular trees that people are really attached to that impact them and that they want to see retained, but we don't necessarily give those trees any more weights than another tree.
That's right.
And it is a little difficult to respond to that concern because there's just a requirement you meet the units. It doesn't say of those units a certain, you should have priority over the larger trees, right? Or however we want to place a value on those trees. We don't have that kind of weight system
but
makes them consider those over something else.
We did the master plan for Yellow Terrace.
Yes.
I know it was 90 acres, whatever it was, and there was existing urban trees. We worked out with the city a tier categorization of all the trees. So this is a tier one tree.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be taken down.
Yeah.
How come this?
This is a tier two tree, and then it had a definition. And this is a tier three tree, and it had a definition.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability of being able to take that into site plan design, it was fantastic.
I bet.
And then you actually had something to hang your hat on to say, you can't do that because that is a tier two tree.
Right.
I was wondering, couldn't you have some sort of rule where when the property is sold, the seller has to do an inventory, and then that inventory then becomes part of the process, and there has to be a tree removal plan as part of the site plan?
And it doesn't, but it doesn't take much for an arborist to walk around.
Say
he broke one of the most valuable trees on the piece of property.
Yeah, and maybe they have to document the tier one and tier two, but the tier three and four, they don't count them.
No, absolutely.
I had a huge eye open because I went around with Mike Jenner on the Madison property, and it was really interesting what he said, what to stay and what ought to go, based on that same logic.
Yes.
So this is obviously something the tree committee at some point can discuss, and I think be very interested in discussing. It has come up, with the fire department. They didn't like, they felt it was onerous that they had to have an arborist identify all the trees they're going to retain, which when I look at how few they retain, it's like...
Yeah. Well, that disincentivizes retaining trees.
But this is a conversation, and there's the other side of it, that the landowners, developers are going to complain that it's expensive for them to have to identify all the trees. It might be a On a smaller lot, I think it's more reasonable because, you know, obviously if you've got an acre of forest, I mean, that's really, that's going to be very time consuming.
Yeah, no, but any arborist would walk around the forest and say, it's a special tree.
Yeah, then it's quick.
You just and it gets a tag, and it's a tier one tree.
Okay.
You don't have to survey every darn tree.
No, the nice thing is the tier one tree will preserve quite an area if you have to go to the drip line.
That's right.
Identify special trees.
Yeah, and I'll give you an example. I just did this for a lot for the city. And I walked on and I was like, whoa, you know, there's like 150 trees. But if you're just taking the tier ones, you go, oh, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Because an acre won't support many tier one trees, you know. Mm-hmm. So that would be a great way to do that. That would make it so much quicker.
Okay.
And so any intelligent designer would want those trees located anyway.
Yes.
Yep. So if every
all
time
designers are that intelligent.
But every time an intelligent or not so intelligent designer came and showed us their plans, then they came with their building footprint and they showed us where the tier one and tier two trees
are.
It's
not fundamental.
Then we could see, you know, what's happening.
Yeah.
We could actually understand the project so much better. Okay.
So on the subject of things we would like, the Planning Commission is not a recommendation body. It's a yes or no body. Is that correct?
No, it's a recommendation body.
It's a recommendation body.
I think there might be a couple things that they have a yes
mm-hmm.
and no on.
I think it's like a noise variance, right? It's very minor.
But
so
most things are recommendations.
You're right.
Right.
They are.
To the city council or the hearing examiner.
That's
right. So
there's no
way.
Still making a, we're making a recommendation to the planning director.
Right.
The planning director passes our recommendation on to the planning commission. Or... Do some of our things go straight to City Council? I thought they went all to the Planning Commission.
Almost all of them go to the Planning Commission.
Yeah, and so it goes to the Planning Commission, then they make a recommendation to the City Council.
They make a recommendation to the Director. A lot of decisions are
back to the Director.
Correct, and then some of them go to the Hearing Examiner.
Okay.
So City Council looks at final subdivisions.
Okay, sorry.
That's okay.
We're required to rubber stamp. Basically. Required. We don't get. The land is already cleared, and all the infrastructure.
Say that again.
The city council sees subdivisions after the land has actually been cleared, roads put in, all the utilities put in.
And why is that?
That's a good question.
I mean,
that's
why do you
that's on my that? List of things. But to get back to
what do you look at it for?
I don't know. It's like a formality. So it's possible that the design review board could carry more than just an advisory.
That's what I'm wondering.
I think according to state law, and I'm not necessarily advocating for this. I don't know if it's what we want to do, but your decisions could carry more weight than they currently do. That's a possibility from what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not real familiar with state law in regards to design review boards, but I think we have a lot of flexibility in how we set up our design or our development review or land use review process.
To be honest, it is only necessary if the design review board does not have the full support of the planning department. If the design review board felt that they were always going to be listened to and they always had the support of the planning staff and the planning director, whether we're making a recommendation or a decision is to me not that important. It is times when we have felt that we have made a recommendation and it has been ignored or not taken seriously, or we have been bullied into having to act, that we have yearned for yes or no. I mean, and so I don't know how the rest of you feel.
Well,
about
I agree with that.
That.
I've always felt like, oh, I wish we had teeth, but now I almost think it's better to be advisory because once you have teeth, then it's politicized and. Yeah. I can see campaigns against design review board members and campaigns to get certain ones in that facilitate this. That. And frankly, this body changes due to the people on it. I wasn't here when Visconti went through, but apparently there was a different discussion than I think we would have about it.
So you're thinking that if you had a yes or no vote, it would be less collaborative than it otherwise could be in the direction you're moving.
One thing Alan's been trying to promote and project us as is a helpful body, not an onerous obstacle in your way kind of body, that we're actually trying to collaborate on a positive outcome.
Get people to be doing the right thing.
And find ways to achieve it.
So here's
could I just interject one little thing there? That puts a lot of pressure on the planner to understand our design intent. So it's for planners who aren't necessarily designers, how do we make sure that recommendation that we make, that they fully understand it, so that they can translate it on to
the... If the recommendations are backed up by specific things like this Tier 1, Tier 2, I mean, that's just one example, but if there's something to point to that everyone understands in some way, then that's the backup.
And I believe we'd be moving in this direction. More open communication during our meetings of everyone stating their point of view. I think the planners are helped by that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because they can, whether it's going back to what's on the tape or going to the summary in the minutes, they can really go back and...
Can you get time to do that? The planners get time to do that?
I think that there's the first 10 minutes is between just the planner and the DRB, and we get to hear some of your concerns and stuff for voice. That's really been helpful, because I kind of know what areas you're concerned about going into that review with the applicant. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and I wanted to end up... So if we've got an opinion that's strong and you've heard it, how does that help you convince the applicant that they should listen? In other words, you're the planner and you've absorbed what we've said. Now you're saying that to the applicant.
Well, they usually come in right after you all say it, and I've seen it work where you all have been able to work that out and express it to them. So I don't think there's been a problem in the translation.
Are they under any obligation to pay any attention?
Well, I guess I might recommend that we expand your scope to continue to be recommending, but right now, really... The code says you're to review a project against the guidelines, but you guys have so much more to offer than just guidelines. So you're looking at the general site layout and design. So maybe if there's just kind of a general statement that your purview, the guidelines are kind of secondary, what I feel when I come to you. You all look at, you're doing a much broader view and service. Yeah, and I think... Just adding a statement that's part of your purview is to recommend just a general site layout and amenities. So you could talk about trails and community gardens and community solar patches. You know, you could have that piece that's part of your review that's more of a generalized statement that might give you more broader recommendation.
But I thought that when I started last June, I was really struck by how whether we felt respected, whether I felt respected within this group, was planner by planner.
Okay.
Some planners are gone now. There's just been a changeover, and things have gotten a lot, I think, better.
Yeah.
No question. Yeah, really, especially since you came back from paternity leave. So I want to say that.
Okay.
Things have gotten better. But I thought there was an opportunity during the Lattimore report, and we made the point to him pretty clearly, because I remember I was pretty vocal, but I think we all were, that we wanted to, whatever that process was that he was going to recommend, or that he was going to make sure that the design review board was in that in a more formal way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's not clear to me that that's ever happened,
right,
or that that was his charge, or that that's what he's being held to at this point to do.
Right. At what point will that happen? Right.
Or will it?
Yeah.
And I think that was what I was hopeful for.
Okay.
Was that by them seeing us really in there, almost in the box, in the Gantt chart?
Yes.
If we're in there, in the box, on a time frame, then I think that brings our importance to all the planners more.
Sure.
Can I chime in? I thought what you just said was really interesting about, you know, our involvement and, you know, more than just guidelines. And I'm wondering if maybe there's some precedent here in other jurisdictions of having potentially two tracks where you get someone like Ray who has some aspirational commitments. He's made commitments to this land, and he's identified the land trust as a partner. And he's having trouble going through this long, arduous process. And maybe there's a simplified approval process where we say, wow, he's actually trying to do good, which is different than, like, trying to make sure someone meets, you know, kind of our criteria for doing the least harm, right? So I don't know how that works exactly, how we identify that, but maybe there's this collaborative discussion where it's the DRB, planning, engineering, and we have more of a group discussion, and then we approve the project based on that discussion and that collaborative process. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there's, you know, like, in Vancouver, the city of Vancouver, British Columbia, they have a planning process that they implemented years ago that was sort of similar, where they identified different zones where they wanted development, and they eased some of the restrictions, but they didn't want development in more historic single-family neighborhoods. And so they kind of created it was harder to get approval there, right? So they created two tiers, and it actually steered development in one direction, and it worked, right? It created a very walkable,
you'd have to be pretty specific about those
community
reasons why.
So they met their goals through something similar, but I don't know if it would be appropriate for our body to be part of the approvals process where we feel like the applicant is a partner, you know, instead of the applicant saying, oh no, it's, you know, here's another process that I have to go through,
right,
get approved, get the DRB's recommendation, and then have to go get approval. Maybe if they saw it as, hey, I want to work with the DRB, and I'm bringing in the land trust, or I'm bringing in...
I think it's a great idea, Jason. And I know in Seattle, and Debbie Lester mentioned this in some conversation I was having with her, that in Seattle, they have expedited process for particular projects that are meet certain goals or standards.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good idea. I would obviously want to look at the legalities of what we can do with it, but I hope we could keep that on our radar screen, because that could be one way to steer, like, to say to people that you do something like this project, but they're not using all the density they have. And there's other things they could be encouraged to do, but to try and steer people in that direction and say, you're going to get rewarded because we're going to expedite the process. I think that's something we definitely should be doing.
Yeah, look, I'm clear where the rewards come for a subdivision developer. We have Ray, who's got a vision, and it's, to my mind, not the standard developer's vision. Small homes and so forth. I mean, we could see the same sign coming through with the three-car garage.
Yeah, right.
McMansion kind of approach. And I don't know how and where that... I mean...
Yeah.
I'm not sure where incentives come from for, you know...
So we need a checklist or something.
Yeah. Well, he's having... I think what I was proposing is something like, there's a process, there's a different process that you would go through, and it would be...
That would require staffing in the public works department.
Yeah, right.
So it's have a streamlined, expedited path.
But I like the collaborative review you're talking about, because a lot of what we heard from Ray was specific to the development engineering requirement. So what if a development engineer attended these meetings? And I was also thinking that for short plats, if you dedicate additional open space, you can do 9 lots as a short plat, as opposed to our requirement is 4 lots as a short plat, and anything above 4 is a subdivision. But if you do additional open space, you can go up to 9 lots as a short plat. And what's the incentive is you don't go to the hearing examiner, which just takes more time to go through that process. So thinking like about your tree idea, like, could you, if you save more tier one trees, or, you know, what kind of things, if you drop density, could we ask for people to do to go on this short plat track, which is with a, it, we could weave into their DRB review, possibly. I think there's a way.
So he's doing short plat here.
He is short platting because he's doing over 40% open space, uh-huh. And he's doing up to 9 lots. So he is, right. That wasn't discussed in the beginning, but he's taking advantage of that incentive that's already built into the code. So, and I'm sorry, so I have to
leave.
Yeah. I'm so glad I got to be here. I'm excited to be a part of this. So thank you for allowing me. And
thank you, Heather.
Happy holidays,
everyone.
See you. Bye.
Just
to clarify, Chris, what I was suggesting is that in order to ease the process, you may have certain criteria that you don't have to meet prescriptively, right? Mm-hmm. That you show in a performance way you've met some criteria, like a living building challenge. I'm starting to sound like a broken record, but that, you know, that you're meeting some other criteria rather than going through all, like, rather than putting the load on the engineers to make sure all the boxes are checked, you know, they come before a mixed committee that several times, doesn't have to be once, and the public, but basically that's what Vancouver did years ago, and I don't know if it's still being done or what other municipalities there are.
So could a developer under your scenario come in and see there's two ways to go,
yeah,
and choose?
Right.
I mean, to choose, to be, take the more collaborative approach,
right,
with the incentive being it would go faster, it would be da da da, and other people would go, I don't want to go through that process.
And I think the reason if they would take that first approach is because they're willing to take a bit of a risk,
yeah,
right? Because right, they say, oh, it's faster, but I'm taking on the responsibility of more commitments and more collaborative nature,
right,
and more community benefits.
Yeah, no, this is great. I think this is absolutely something we got to do. I think people, you know.
Let me ask a softball question to you. Do you think the new council would approve subdivisions for the DRB?
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. Especially with some of the stuff that we're talking about here and the potential for a more collaborative process with the planning department, planning commission, public works, and the public to create better quality development on the island. Everybody wants that. And in fact, we could accomplish that.
When you talk about this with other council members, does it make sense that the Design Review Board have a graduated introduction to subdivision review? I don't want someone to turn around and say, there's no design guidelines for the Design Review Board to rank a project against. Therefore, write some design guidelines first, and then after those are all approved and signed off, then we might get around.
Oh, I see.
So if we do a graduated approach, yeah, where we say they immediately start to come,
yep,
to us,
yeah,
and we are formulating, just like today, we're, yeah, formulating the important things,
yep,
that need to be addressed in a particular subdivision,
yep,
review,
yeah,
and then everyone can get to a point where they actually are all agreeing, planning, engineering, review boards, they're all getting to this comfortable place where they say, yes, this is what we need to do. Now let's formalize that.
Is it though that in the work that those people have to do, like in public works and so on, is it that at any given meeting they don't know the codes well enough, especially when they're conflicting, to actually be able to offer really constructive stuff at that time, or that they've got to go away and really read their code? In other words, if we're all around a table and trying to come up with some decisions, for some of the codes and things, it's kind of a bit hard to do that because there's so many. Like, I've been to that counter four times trying to do that removal process, and nobody knows until they get to the next one, and then they
What was it pertaining to up here?
Trying to remove 5,000 square feet of concrete from a backyard.
Okay.
I've had to do a SAR, a SEPA.
I think what we're trying to do, what we're trying to do, is we're trying to get that collaborative discussion occurring early.
Okay. Yes.
And for the Quixel, you know, that would have been 3.5 years ago, because he's just been working on it for a year and a half.
Right.
Quixel's were working on it for 2 years prior to that,
right.
And they were the drivers that got to that, except with two more lots.
So it's a more inclusive pre-op, right?
So
pre-op.
But it's right up front. It's
right.
First conversation they had with their site designer, we'd like to know what that is all about.
Yeah.
Not after someone's spent all this money doing all of this work.
Right.
Which is...
And not when you see it, when it's already been cleared and the roads are in.
Right.
Like, so it's just a more comprehensive pre-op.
We want to see things very early on so that we can have an impact.
Right. And it's this idea that we're sort of taking these early reviews. It's like a beta testing, right? We're just having a conversation. And it'll help us develop the standards that we're working on. But right now, we're just having a conversation.
Identify areas in the code that are problematic.
Right, because somebody else is saying
and
we can't
maybe
do that.
We can help you.
Because we could easily have advised him, you should do another arc here, and he goes over to Public Works and they say,
okay.
Right.
So the best person in the world to do a beta test on subdivisions would be Ray on his next project. I mean,
that's probably true.
I mean, you know, the next time he does a project, if he has
no, actually, we would like one of these nasty.
Yeah, we want that guy.
That's true. I'm assuming that person wouldn't come up. I'm assuming that person wouldn't volunteer for it.
Well, he has come twice.
It's not being voluntary.
We want the next woman line to get this going right away.
Yeah, that's what
I don't know how you would pass this as a city council, but if it was a requirement to have a conversation with the DRB, I think that's all we're asking.
Yeah, right?
Absolutely.
I don't think that would be too hard. Right.
Yeah, we just need a...
So that would be your first council meeting in January?
There's going to be a lot going on in that first meeting.
But this is the one that will save the most trees. This one will save the most trees.
We need to put together an agenda bill and what we actually are proposing. And I think it would be changing the Title II of the description of the design review board. Basically, it describes your role there. I think that would have to be changed, so... No, but it's something we can do. I mean, I think we're going to have a council that's receptive to that sort of thing. We're not going to have the stone wall that I've come up against every time I've suggested. I think there's people who are afraid of having more process. And, just got to get past that. It's going to make things better.
Streamline process. It's going to streamline the process. I mean, that's
the argument.
It doesn't take $50,000 worth of consultant's time for us to tell you that this is a great way to streamline the process. You know.
So I want to mention something because it kind of pertained to what we were talking about earlier. I know when you were looking at Virginia Mason up there at the Wisconsin site.
Mm-hmm.
There was a discussion about putting a landmark tree by the entrance. And I saw Charlie and kind of shaking her head, like smiling. Have you been, by there and you saw the final site? There's no tree by the entrance. And it would really be great if there were a tree. I don't, it's just, to me, it just illustrated that how applicants can come in and listen and
can they kind of agree with something?
But that gets back. That gets back to the planning staff, because Peter has had this discussion many times. Who goes back and makes sure they do what they're supposed to have done? It's not the design review board who are the police. The planning staff are supposed to, and the building permit staff are supposed to be on top of, have they done everything that they were required to do in the process.
I call it the Hinoki Cypress.
Yeah, but I don't know whether that... I think the thing, it goes back to what I was saying before, if we say to the planning staff, this is what we think, this is our recommendation...
That's where the teeth are lacking.
Yeah, that's where the teeth are lacking, because if the planner or the inspector doesn't really get that information and retain it and know about it and diarise it and go, that's a long journey to get to that at the end of the journey. Yeah, how does it happen?
And we just recommended, right? We suggested that would be a nice thing to do. That doesn't equate in any way to do it.
But they basically violated your recommendation. Right?
Sure. Exactly right.
I mean, you always go to the staff's report, and it's the director that makes these decisions. If you take a look and read the code, the director makes it.
Yeah.
And he or she gets the recommendation, even from the planning commission, and then from yourself. So, and there's just so many decisions that you can make in the process.
But the thing is, in my book, the planning director would have to say, you know, we discussed that, if there was no question about it. The planning director would have to say, they don't need to put that tree there in his final report.
Right.
Because if it's in our recommendations, it's in.
Yeah, I'm like...
But is it in a short list of ... So does anybody can go, oh, yeah, that one.
See, no, that's
if it's in a narrative, you can't find it.
That's where there's a breakdown.
It's a narrative.
That can be really improved now that there's receptive planning, is that the recommendations do get from here to there, which I don't think they were doing for a long time.
Because if they're in the minutes, it's a narrative, it's not easy to find those recommendations.
It's a staff report.
I have a suggestion that you actually have something you write down for a project. You have a form, and you can write down what your motion is.
Approved based
on conditional.
Yeah,
you got conditions, and that needs. And you can. We can stipulate that needs to go into the staff report, the project report.
It's like a.
I have the
recommendation sticker.
No, it's like a CA stamp. Approved as submitted.
We're not just giving a blanket approval of this.
We have been told in the past that we've ignored it, but we are actually not allowed to condition.
Yeah.
That's right.
You want to convince the director that, I mean, actually the staff person's right, he can't do all this work. So the staff provides the report, and then, like in Wisconsin, the staff person wrote the report, and then afterwards the director signs. So the director's, he or she makes a decision versus recommendation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you appeal that decision.
Well,
go higher up.
So I'm just wondering if we, I think it's worth further discussion. Obviously, you have to look at what the law allows, but I would be in favor of you guys having the ability to make a recommendation. It does have conditions. Our code presently maybe doesn't allow for that. It sounds like it doesn't. And I don't know if state law precludes that. I don't think it does. I'd be really surprised. Because what's the point of a recommendation that there be a landmark tree in front of the Virginia Mason building with all the developers? Charlie Winslow is shaking his head with a smile on his face, and then they don't do it.
Yeah.
They're just like, kind of schmoozing you.
Yeah.
You give them a... You recommend approval and they don't follow through. So somehow,
Something, because this Madison project with the historic tree, which may not qualify as a Tier 1 tree, I don't know, under that criteria, but somehow something beyond saying, please save that tree.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Our recommendation is condition on that.
Yeah,
it doesn't have on a recommendation.
It's true. Right, long ago, we were trying to put conditions on things, and you said we're not allowed to.
Who said that? Was it Gary?
No, we.
You're allowed to make those conditions.
Josh.
Everyone, I mean, in the previous administration, people were very hung up about whether we were doing things that could be legally challenged.
Well, we should find out.
Yeah. I think they are going to grow some vines up in front of that Virginia Mason. That was one of the things that we said you had to do. They did put some cabling up there.
A tree would be so great.
Yeah.
Just a we need the tree.
Yeah. Ugly book.
Are you going to?
Ron's still has
a I think this has been great.
Okay.
We don't want to. Been discussing basically all this stuff since the beginning of the meeting with Ray, and I've got enough for now to get a good feeling, and we can continue the conversation.
Our next meeting isn't until I think the 8th of
January.
Oh, we're not doing the 18th.
It's we're not doing the 18th of December. January, we agreed to do two special meetings because they both fall on holidays. The first and third. So we're doing the second and fourth.
Which is
the
8th and the 22nd.
Yeah.
Right. Correct. Okay. Well, I've been over the last year, I have to say that I think the design review board's really a lot different than it was when I started. I don't know, I'm not taking credit. I'm just saying it's really grown.
That sounded good. I didn't mean it that way.
We all heard it.
Is different because Joseph Benson joined it.
I talked before Benson. But I just think I think it's evolved over the last year in a very positive way. Yeah. I really do. I feel like that one love.
So are you?
We started at the same time, though, right?
We got sure it's
the same. He's on vacation right now.
Because he's still on.
But we're missing one person, and I have no clue about a new appointee or whether anyone responded to the ad.
Oh, they put an ad
on the line.
Supposedly,
they did an ad mint on the website as well.
Okay, so
what's
you know
the other date?
I haven't heard anyone reply.
I asked about a week ago and haven't heard anything.
So, what are you looking for? Another architect, designer, artist?
We don't need any more architects. We need artists.
Oh, sorry.
Somebody like engineering.
Someone in engineering will be great.
That would be really good, yeah.
Okay.
But we really don't need any more architects. I mean, I think we've got the architect side covered.
Okay.
And then everyone ought to be giving some thought as to who they would like to be chair next year.
You.
Well, it comes up first meeting in January, we have to decide.
Well, if you're not running, that's a problem.
Well, I'm on till.
No, I mean you're running for re-election.
Oh, I.
Reasonably, he's going to move on.
Yeah, he's going
to
move on.
I'm totally happy to do whatever the design would like me to do. Next month.
Oh.
I might have changed my mind. On Well, see how Ron does at the city council.
Right.
If he gets nowhere, then get it. No. Okay, I need a motion to adjourn.
I'm moving to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor.
All right.
That was a vote for Jason, too, by the way.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.